White Sox general manager Rick Hahn, Second City veteran Tim O'Malley, and from Public Enemy DJ Lord. And now, here's your host, a man who is mad that someone else took the name DJ Lord, Justin Kaufman.
I went to the registry. I'm like, yes, hi, I'm DJ Lord. I'd like to be DJ Lord. They're like, already taken. Oh. How about DJ Overlord? No, that's taken too. How about Wally Phillips? Is that DJ Wally Phillips? Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on WGN Radio. We got an outstanding show for you tonight. First off, is Chicago in danger of becoming a one newspaper town? This has been an argument for a while. Some say yes, and others, for the first time in a long time, say heck no. With the news that Michael Farrell left the Sun-Times to invest in the Chicago Tribune, are we entering a new day for newspaper wars here in town? I hope so. It's always makes for a better news experience when the two papers are fighting, right? So hopefully that's what we'll see here. Also, the Chicago White Sox are definitely in the Cubs' shadow this year. But pundits and baseball forecasters are giving the White Sox a fighting chance in 2016. The Sox general manager Rick Hahn's going to join me to talk about the offseason, what they can do to guarantee a quick start. This is the year where the Sox don't suck it up in April, right? They get off to a start that then, and we're going to talk to him about the idea of what's that take? A different approach to spring training? We'll talk to him about it. My guest tonight at the big table is Tim O'Malley. O'Malley's lived a full life in comedy. He's now an instructor and director for Second City and other places. But he once shared the stage with Chris Farley and Tim Meadows, but he never got picked for SNL and beyond. Tim talks to us about that time and his near-death experiences with heroin, crack cocaine, and dealing with addiction. It's going to be a powerful segment we're going to have at 8 o'clock at the big table tonight with Tim O'Malley. And tonight we preview this year's Louder Than a Bomb Poetry Festival. It's the biggest youth poetry festival in the country. And Kevin Colville will be here to talk about it. He founded it back in 2000. Also, DJ Lord. DJ Lord. Huh. How'd you get that name? Just gave yourself that name. DJ Lord, the turntable is for Public Enemy. Yes, the Public Enemy. Terminator X to the side. DJ Lord, you're in. DJ Lord is going to be performing at the Metro as part of one of the final shows of Louder Than the Bomb, and he'll be joining us to talk about his involvement in the festival. All that, plus it's Friday night, so that means it's time for the frying pan. Steve Gadlin from Shark Tank will pitch his new idea, and we will give it a yay or an A. My guess? I'm feeling good. Last week I felt like more and more people were listening to Steve. And I've pitched me first, the idea of a fob that you could put and rub over the gizmos that the restaurant give you to, like, the, what do you call that thing, the alarm to let them know that, you know, that your table's ready, that you can rub it over there and it would go off automatically and you can jump ahead in the line. The me first. Everyone I told is like, that's a good idea. Ah, I like that. That's a good idea. Our listeners on last Friday night didn't really like it. But I'm telling you, it's got legs, and he promises an even better one tonight. Steve Gadlin will be here at 10 o'clock. All that plus news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. And production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download. All right, so let's get to it. Shall we start with the carryout? This is our nightly segment that we do. I mean, I don't think we've missed it. I mean, even when we aren't on with the Blackhawks, we do one of these. We put them up on WGNradio.com. You can get the podcast, too, on iTunes. It's the carryout. It's a nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you don't have to. Here's today's top stories. The Chicago Archdiocese is looking to reorganize, and over the next few years, hundreds of Chicago churches could close. On the same day, TCF banks say that they will close all the banks inside Jewel Osco. You know, it's a sad day when I have to wonder which closing will have a bigger impact. I mean, church is great, but I can buy beer and cash my check. Maybe instead of closing, both could merge.
Yeah, the Catholic TCF Bank of St. Patrick's, where we're offering half off on rosaries and savings accounts. Looks like Mayor Emanuel may not push for a lakefront location for the Lucas Museum after all. A judge paved the way for a lawsuit against putting the Star Wars Museum along Lake Michigan, as that is supposed to be sacred land reserved for public museums and auto shows. Now, Mayor Emanuel may just be making sure that if the courts rule against him, the Lucas team doesn't just pack up and go to Oakland. I've heard some churches and a jewel bank is looking to close. How about the St. Patrick's TCF Bank of Obi-Wan Kenobi? Man, I should get into government. I got such great ideas. In politics news, the Bernie Sanders campaign was kicked off Tinder for blatantly campaigning instead of, you know, trying to sleep with everybody. Here's a sample. Hey, what's up? You're cute. Want me to send you a picture? Oh, you hate that? You know what I hate? Wall Street. You on Snapchat? Bernie Sanders is on Snapchat. Catch you later. I'm already sick of you. In business tech news, LinkedIn saw a huge stock drop today after a bad quarterly report. Could this be the end of that one social media platform that you never use? Seriously, when's the last time you used LinkedIn? Even the unemployed are like, ooh, new Candy Crush update. Need to delete something off my phone. Yeah, LinkedIn. In news, Robert Feeder is reporting that ABC7's Ron Majors is set to retire. What? No. Who do I send the letter to? Dear Father Time or Republican lawmakers? Please force Ron Majors to stay on the air forever. Sincerely, all of Chicago. Nintendo announced they're nixing a sleep tracker. It would be a bedside contraption. They were hoping to monitor heart levels, REM sleep, etc. Yeah, you heard me right. Nintendo. If you slept well through the night, you got a colorful mushroom that made you double your size. Or so you think. Probably why it was nixed. Who needs sound effects? I make my own sound effects. This weekend, Larry David returns to host SNL. He's been a fan fave with his Bernie Sanders impression, which is eerie, but not as good as mine. Hello? I really hope Sanders does a tap on the shoulder cameo. That's my favorite. They converse with each other. I know it's cheap, but I love it. Who's tapping on my shoulder? Oh, it's the real guy. Hello? Oh, come on. So good. It'll be so good. I can't wait. In weather, it's fine. It's fine out. In sports, this weekend is the Super Bowl. I wonder when the Broncos win, if they'll carry Kubiak and Wade Phillips on the shoulders. Did you watch 30 for 30 last night on the Bears? Same old stories for a national audience, but you aren't human if you didn't tear up a bit at the end. Heroes need heroes, too. When Buddy Ryan's talking to Singletary, he's using sign language like an ape. Get it together. The Bulls try to do the unthinkable tonight, win two straight. They take on the Nuggets in Denver. The Blackhawks won again last night on the appropriate game winner from the captain, Jonathan Toews. They're in Dallas tomorrow for a showdown with the Rising Stars. See what I did there? Actually, they're going the other way. Sharpie. In college hoops, Louisville banned itself from any postseason play, including the NCAA tournament, just because of a sex scandal. When the news reached Champaign, the Illini were like, hey, we have no scandal, but we'd like to ban ourselves from postseason play too. Please, give us a reason. It's not just because we suck. And at Wrigley Field this summer, two shows from the band Fish. Just when you thought the Wrigley Field concerts couldn't get whiter. I mean better. And finally, a new study says that having your home team in the Super Bowl may make you sick. The study says that it has to do with stress. And in another study, it says that the people of Chicago, specifically Chicago Bears fans, are the healthiest people in the world. Well, that's the carryout for February 5th, 2016. Have a great weekend. And don't order the nachos for takeout. They never hold.
I got to work on my Nintendo sound effects. Mario's. It's. You know what I mean? Like, that's Mario. I should have done that. Anyway, coming up, Ken Davis is going to join us. Chicago going to be a one newspaper town? Maybe. It's the download, WGN. Stay with us. All right, coming up, we're going to talk to Ken Davis. Ken Davis is the host of Chicago Newsroom. And we're going to talk about what a week for media here in town. I mean, the Michael Farrell story, Ron Majors retiring, even, you know, plagiarism stories, journalists with connections to Chicago. So much going on. We're going to talk to Ken about that coming up after the news. Rob, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Joe, you got big plans for the weekend? Are you going to do like an Anna DeVellante's 50 people at your house?
Not quite that many. We weren't overly ambitious this year. Just family and close friends. Yeah, so we're hosting, which is nice because that'll allow me to have that extra bourbon. So, but yeah, no, we're looking forward to it.
You're always looking for allowances.
I tell you what, I said earlier. The nostalgia side of me wants to see Peyton Manning go out on top. So
yeah.
I'm pulling for the Broncos.
I'd like to see that too. I also have that fondness for Chico Rivera, who we saw a little bit of him last night in one of the posters. You know, he was in the poster, and Peanut Tillman, who's on that team. Not as much Jared Allen. I could care less about Jared.
You know, I'll tell you what. One analyst said it best about Cam Newton, the quarterback for the Panthers. This guy is defensive end playing quarterback.
Yeah, so amazing.
He is just phenomenal and very fun to watch.
When you watch him roll, like on a designed run play, like when he did that sweep, he looks bigger than it. I mean, you just imagine if you're a safety and you're like, oh, the quarterback's rolling out, get him.
You know,
now Cam Newton, man.
Yeah, I mean, here you are, a linebacker, 6'2", 6'3", you know, pushing 250, and then Cam Newton comes rumbling at you. I don't know, man.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me
all
too.
Right. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, what a week for news about the news. That's a good way to put it. Today, Robert Feeder reported that Ron Majors will be retiring this year. Wow. Yeah, not wow. I guess it's not surprising. I mean, he's been on the air for so long, but I can't imagine a Chicago television news without Ron Majors. Yesterday, we got word that Michael Farrow was now the major shareholder for the Chicago Tribune and that he was relinquishing duties at the Sun-Times. And earlier this week, another journalist, this one with Chicago ties, caught up in a plagiarism scandal. Ken Davis is a longtime journalist and the host of Chicago Newsroom on CanTV.
Long time.
And he's my guest tonight. Ken, good to see you.
You know, it hasn't been the same since Fahey Flynn left. I mean, let's face it. You know, I mean, Ron Majors was around for a while.
But, a little bit. So let's start with this, you know, because I read a lot of pieces about the deal with the Tribune and Michael Farrell taking over. Robert Feeder's piece was like, you know, expect a merger.
Mm-hmm.
Then you read Neil Steinberg's column in the Sun-Times. It's like, the Sun-Times is so grateful that Michael Farrell is gone,
right,
and we're ready to compete now. We are ready to be a two newspaper town. Which one, where are we at?
Well, obviously nobody knows, but our job is to sit here and blow hot air and pretend
Michigan
like
Avenue.
We do know, right?
Right.
All the people walking by, look, there's two experts sitting in the glass bowl. I would say that the wild card in all of this is Bruce Sagan. I mean, you know, if you read Steinberg yesterday, that was a phenomenal piece that Neil wrote. He was the publisher of the Hyde Park Herald. He's been around in journalism for years and years and years. And suddenly he emerges as the guy. He's sort of running the Sun-Times.
And the candor in that the things that he talked about to the Sun-Times staff, the way he talked, we got a terrible website, we're going to fix it.
Right.
You know
what,
Farrell's gone, good, we got no debt, and we're ready to rock.
Exactly.
It felt like, at least from Neil's standpoint, felt like the company was a little bit invigorated.
Yeah. Now, of course, I mean, you're right. Feeder has a very different take on it, and let's face it, you know, we are all subjects of King Feeder. Whatever he says is the truth. We all of us, first thing we do is read Feeder. However, it might not be like that. I mean, there's a possibility that it's not. If Farrow has his eyes on the Tribune, my sense he's bitten off way more than he can chew, and he won't be too worried about the Sun-Times for a good long time.
For a while.
I mean, you know, when they took over the Reader, remember, it was the same thing. We were all saying, oh, my God, the Reader is going to become like an insert in the Sun-Times, right?
It hasn't happened, right.
It didn't happen, I'm sure partly because he just was too busy with everything else he had to do.
Well, do we have a pension? I mean, In the media circles or people who are interested in this and even listeners out there at WGN Radio, we kind of have this way of always gloom and doom in the media in the way that, oh, they're cutting other people.
This is
the end of an era, the end of one newspaper town. What are we going to do? But we saw, just like you said, with the Reader is still very strong and doing great over there with Jake. And then you've got the Tribune, which, you know, now has Michael Farrell, which, you know, is at the top, and the Tribune's doing some great work. And the Sun-Times, you know, for as much as how difficult that transition has been, and a lot of it had to deal with layoffs and all the kind of cutbacks that the Tribune or the Sun-Times said, you know, one of the things that came out, they have no debt.
Well, it occurs to me that there's a variant on that old thing about – We pundits have reported 20 of the last no collapses of the Chicago Sun-Times, you
right.
know? I mean, for, what, 30 years, we've been confidently predicting that in the next 6 months, that paper is going to go away. And somehow or other, it doesn't. And I do believe that, you know, I don't want to get too patriotic here, but I really do believe that it's because of the value of the unbelievably good people who work there. And I don't work there. I have no horse
right.
in this race. But, you know, when you think about the quality of the reporting that even now is being done, you could probably be working for a startup website and have more job security than those poor folks have, but they just keep cranking it out. Despite all the layoffs, despite all the, you know, the cutbacks and the early buyouts and everything else, there's still a good core of very solid reporters and journalists, and they're still doing what I consider to be the two things that a print or a print-oriented news organization still has to do to be relevant. They have good columnists and commentary. It's still pretty solid. And the other thing is investigations. And they are still doing some of the best investigations
yeah.
in town.
Well, on the other side of the other side of, I guess, River North, the mm-hmm. Chicago Tribune, mm-hmm. You know, the Chicago Tribune, Michael Farrow comes in. I mean, Michael Farrow did the job he was set out to do, which was to write the financial ship at the Chicago mm-hmm. Sun-Times. And that was not a good for people,
yeah.
meaning, you know,
yeah.
so many stories about layoffs, the whole photography department at the Sun-Times. If you're watching this story or observer or maybe working the company, are you afraid that history is going to repeat itself with the Chicago Tribune?
You know, there's no way to know, but I guess I'm not quite as sanguine about Michael Farrow's reign at the Sun-Times as you seem to be. I mean, let's face it, there are just horror stories about a guy who came in who just frankly had no idea what he had bought and what he was about to do. And he had all of these wild, crazy ideas of things that he was going to do that he started, realized it wasn't
yeah.
going to work, and stopped. And here's the thing that I lay at his door. He was a digital guy. I mean, he made his hundreds of millions or whatever he did in digital, right? So he buys the Sun-Times and you think, wow, this is exactly what they need. A guy with money and a digital background, he's going to finally fix the website. Well, I don't know if we're allowed to be this caustic on the air, but their website, I mean, it's just
it's
one
bad,
of the
yeah.
worst websites in journalism.
It's almost becoming a fact.
Yeah, I mean, it's
been talked about enough that
right,
it's sort of like,
right.
Oh, yeah, that is true. Even the Sun-Times board, Sagan is like, yeah, it's bad.
Especially people who leave the Sun-Times the right. day after they leave. They'll tell you, you know, I did all this work. I couldn't find it on my own website. But let's let that lie. There's a possibility now that this debt-free company, invigorated with somebody at the top who just is saying, come on, let's go out there and, you know, kick butt, that they might be able to fix that website. There certainly are people in Chicago, you and I probably know 200 of them, who could fix that website.
Mm-hmm.
They just need a little bit of money.
You know,
little bit of resources.
I don't know much about. I mean, we had a great conversation with Jim Kirk mm-hmm. talking about it here on the Download. And you know, with Michael Farrow, digital doesn't mean websites. And
no,
I think that
not
there's,
at all. There,
I think that that's part of it too, is that they put a lot more effort. And Natasha Kareki talked about it today in her Politico
yeah,
column
political.
About a lot of the failures.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've had a lot of business leaders in here, a lot of people who've worked with Michael Farrow know Michael Farrow.
yeah.
Say failure is part of the game,
yeah, yeah.
and you put it up and you put it down. You know, like it doesn't mm-hmm. work, you keep moving. So in a way, I mean, part the website's bad. We know it's bad, but it does feel like startup culture. You know, the idea of something failing and trying something new, something failing, something new.
Well, yeah, I'll go along with that partway. But the fact of the matter is that there are hundreds of really, really good news websites out there that could
yeah.
be emulated. And you're right. It's more than the website. It's the whole digital presence. And there again, it's so disappointing. Look at the things that they started and tried with their video, with the early and often mm-hmm. site that they did.
The grid.
Some of these things held incredible promise, and they were doing really well, and they hired really talented people, and they were really getting somewhere. But there wasn't any. There was no follow through with it. It just all everything just kept collapsing all the time.
Ken Davis is the host of Chicago Newsroom on CAN TV, which is Fridays, right? Friday and
yeah.
then throughout the weekend.
I forgot Thursdays at 6:30. Sorry.
Thursdays. So catch it online too.
And anytime at Chicago Newsroom.
He's my guest tonight. You know, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Let's talk about some of the other stories that have making news about news here in Chicago this week. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Ken Davis. We're talking media. A huge week. It's week in review, really. I mean, this is pretty crazy to think that there's been so many stories about the news this week.
Yeah.
I mean, Ron Majors today capped it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because we had Jay Levine in here about a week ago, and we talked about the future of 10 o'clock news.
Mm-hmm.
Because over time, you're seeing a lot of networks, even locally, put their money in the morning because now they're competing with the internet, and the 10 o'clock news is almost like too late.
Win the morning.
Yeah. But he also says that there's something great about, you know, having the ability to have something at 10 o'clock at night that, you know, is going to wrap up the day. But guys like Ron Majors, they've been a part of Chicago's media landscape for
years. There just isn't anything you can say about Ron Majors. It's sort of like there's everything else, and then there's Ron Majors in this little category by himself. He's done everything, and everything he's ever touched has been done with class and style and
number one.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, what can one say except, wow, thank you, Ron, and you know, all the best to
now,
you.
Now, he didn't go on record, which I loved his quote in Rob Feeder's piece today, where he's like, you know, we know each other for a long time, Rob, and you know I don't talk about contracts.
Right.
So I'm like, that's classy.
Right.
That's so nice.
Right.
It was the nicest no comment I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah.
On the other side of the spectrum, let's talk about some of the bigger stories that happened.
The
non-Ron Majors stories.
Yeah.
A letter was sent up from the editor of The Intercept, which is a startup news, investigative news site, and they talked about a journalist named Juan Thompson, who they said was fabricating sources and covering up when questioned about some sources that were in his stories, most notably a brother of Dylan Roof or brother-in-law or cousin
Dalton.
Or something like that. Yeah. That said some stuff about why he would have killed people, African-Americans in that church. And they said that, you know, that may not even have been true.
That there might not even, there apparently isn't even such a person.
Yeah. And you know, it became a big story also because Juan had Chicago connections. He worked at DNA Info, and he also worked at WBEZ.
You were his mentor, I
and
assume.
I was not his mentor. That mentors is a very particular word. But Juan did. I did work with Juan. He was an intern of the afternoon shift, which was a show on WBEZ, and he was there for a couple months, maybe, booking segments, putting stuff together. Never doing reporting.
I understand
like
he got
that.
Barack Obama for
it was
but Barack Obama didn't show up for some reason.
No, but you know, I was like, I will say that I feel bad, you know, for what he has to go through. I'm not apologizing for what he did in any form. I mean, he's a good kid, and you know, but the bigger issue to me was the fact that he sent a letter to The Intercept's editor, and in that he said, "I'm a Cub reporter. I may make mistakes. I may be sloppy, but The Intercept didn't provide me with any editors or editorial or anything to correct my, you know, sloppy ways."
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I went back this afternoon and read the sort of founding statement on The Intercept, and it's a very broad and very high-toned thing about how they endeavor to be above all the other sites in terms of accuracy and the quality of their journalism. And of course, you know, they have Assange and, you know, they broke all that stuff. So they have some pedigree, but I think it's interesting that a new site that aspires to be what Intercept aspires to be could have this happen on their own watch.
Right.
And What that speaks to, at least initially, is I think the proliferation of sources. I mean, everybody's a content maker now, right? Everybody makes content, and so the number of gatekeepers on that content has
editors,
even if
and
the
producers,
even it were the same number as it was 20 years ago, it wouldn't be adequate. But in fact, that's been shrinking too. So you find even your big newspapers don't have the same fact checkers. They don't have the same editors, copy editors, and everything else as they once had. But at a site like you know, like this one, it's kind of hard to imagine that they could have been exercising that kind of quality control.
And well, what, he said he did, they weren't. That's the thing. He said that they weren't. They said that he was on his own.
But what was interesting, though, Justin, if you look at the number of stories that they've retracted or corrected, excuse me, it's a relatively small number. Most of the stories that he wrote apparently were pretty accurate. And I went back and reread the stuff that he did on the black site in Chicago, Holman Square. Mm-hmm. Now, they're mostly cribbed from other reporters, the stuff that he was doing, which I
kind of aggregate style.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost kind of like a cheesy HuffPost in a way, because it's kind of like they just rewrite stuff from other sources.
And that's a big, that's what a lot of journalists do, especially if someone is just kind of rewrite other work,
But you could imagine a situation like the Dylann Roof thing where, and again, these places are, you know, these are sort of like code monkey farms, I'm sure, where they're just, you know, they're just being told you got to do 15 stories a day or you're not going to get your $5, you know, per story. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying that it's that's the kind of world that most young people
work
in
today. I mean, as we tie the whole conversation together, we just, you know, Michael Farrow, from a business standpoint, got his company to no debt at the Chicago Sun-Times. Mm-hmm. In doing so, he had to lay off, I don't know what the percentage was, but it was a high percentage of people, editors, photographers, a lot of people that earned, are responsible for fact-checking. And so you end up then saying, well, we can pay, you could pay a journalist this much money, but we could pay him half that if they're new.
Right.
And so you do find this sort of weird kind of, you know, startup culture meets
And
that's the problem we're seeing with what happened at The Intercept, really, is this idea that you're trusting young journalists who don't maybe don't have the experience to go it on their own.
You're not saying this, but we're not just using the Sun-Times as our bad example here, because every newspaper in America is doing the same thing. But yes, this is the problem. So you get a guy, you get a guy like Juan Thompson, and he's sitting there and he's got this story. He's supposed to do a story on Dylann Roof. He's got a couple of quotes he's pulled from here and there. He's supposed to embellish it with some more quotes of his own. He doesn't have time to get it, so he just makes a couple of quotes that he thinks are kind of innocuous, just generates them out of thin air. They go through the system. Nobody notices them. People read it and say, wow, that's pretty outrageous what that guy said, and it's just left at that. We have no idea how much of the stuff we consume every day is just pulled out of thin air by the people who create it, because we don't have the policing, you know. So,
I want, for the record, Colleen Henneman, the drunk Cubs fan, is fake. I want to tell everyone on the download when she comes on, that's a character. So I don't want to be lopped into this.
Are you kidding me? I don't think I can go on. I mean, I love her.
She's very accurate.
I was hoping I'd meet her.
Someday.
Someday. But the point to all of this, I think, is that we have these situations where this content is being generated, and it has become more than ever our responsibility to filter it for ourselves. To say, what I'm reading, there's about a 40% chance that most of it is fake, and then go on to the next thing. Because, you know, it is. I mean,
that's a strong way to do it.
Just don't know what else to say. Like I said, I don't want to be one of these old guys sitting around lamenting, you know, there's no quality anymore.
From Ken Davis to your ears, everything you read, you have to bring the added, you have to bring the philosophy that 40% of this is probably not right.
Or here on the radio, except, of course, on the G.
Except on the G, right. Ken Davis, he hosts the Chicago Newsroom talk show on CAN TV, which you can see on Thursdays and then throughout the weekend. Also, you can find it on YouTube. He's a longtime journalist here in Chicago. Ken.
Wait, there's Colleen. She's walking in.
Oh, she left. No, that was just the back of her head. And she's like a ghost. Ken, good to see you.
I got to talk over the tone.
Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My next guest is an improviser, teacher, and director at the Second City. He's one of the first teachers I've ever had at Second City. Tim O'Malley. What a life Tim O'Malley has had in comedy. He was on stage at Second City in the 80s with Chris Farley and Steve Carell and Bob Odenkirk, just to name a few. And he trained closely with the late improv legend Del Close. But you know what? It wasn't just highlights for Tim. There were a lot of lowlights, too. During that time, he struggled with drugs and alcohol and addiction. And Tim's been sober coming up on 20 years now. And he took that experience, those experiences of addiction, and channeled it into his own show, God Show, which ran to critical acclaim back in 2003. Tim is now a fixture on the Chicago comedy scene, not only teaching improv, but now directing improv. He's directing the new group, young group, Scantron, which will perform two shows at the Marty DeMott Theater on February 6th and the 13th. Tim O'Malley, welcome to The Download.
Thank you, Justin. Great to be here.
Good to see you.
And congratulations. It's just great to see you sitting in that chair.
You know what's great about you is you're a Chicago kid.
Yeah.
You grew up in Beverly.
Right.
And made your way up to Second City. I mean, a lot of people come in from other places, and they come here to study comedy. But you came from Chicago. What brought you as a Chicagoan to the Second City?
Well, you know, first of all, we got to put time context. There was, you know, no classes, right? There was Del's class, right. And there was Donnie's class.
Right.
And you had to be, like, invited into the class.
This was what? This was, like, mid-'80s?
1979, 1980.
Okay.
So, you know, I take one class with Judy Morgan up at Players Workshop, and she says to me, you guys got to go down to see Del Close. You know, you guys got to try to get into his class. You know, I'm a Chicagoan, and I'm like, isn't Second City like some tourist trap? You know what I mean? What do I want? You know, I'll just be funny in front of a band because I was a singer in college. You know, and someone will find me and it'll just happen, you know. And this girl says, no, you got to study, you got to learn, you got to figure it out. And she brings me to the class and I watch for like 5 weeks. And then you get this private interview with Del over at the Earl of Old Town. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what have you read and why do you want to be an actor? And, you know, he's smoking and coughing. And, you know, so he does a little interview with you. And all I had read was like Something Wonderful Right Away and Bag Time. You know, which is the story of, you know, Old Town in the old days. And, you know, and just told him that I liked Buckminster Fuller and, some things I thought might, you know, really catch his interest. And he's like, all right, well, come back next week and we'll all vote and decide whether you are going to be in the class.
And it wasn't even about money. It was just more about whether or not they liked you.
Yeah. But I happened to pass the guy that took the money for the class in a bag of mushrooms to hand to Del. And I was accepted that day.
Talk about your time with Del Close, because that is a very glorified legend in Chicago improv. The people who had a chance to have these experiences in the early 80s with Del Close, you know, talk very fondly of him. But there's a lot that goes into that. What was it like for you?
Well, you know, it was scary because, you know, Del's old fashioned kind of like get on stage. I don't know what I want. You know, that's not it. Get off stage. Kind of barking orders and, you know, but half an hour of stories before we get one scene up and then. It was very intimidating, you know. And then if you, like, did anything at someone's expense, you know, you'd be, you know, told, okay, you're not going to be in any scenes for 2 weeks. You got to sit in the upper level or, like, you'd be punished, you know, and stuff like that. So, you know, it was scary, intimidating, you know. You know, we looked up to him like, you know, like our own little idol. So this, you know, the stories of drugs and drug use and being close to the dark side, you know, it's reminiscent of, you know, going to the O'Neill on the walls.
Yeah,
opiate, you know, addicted dead novelists, you know. Same kind of thing where we're going to look up to all the the drug addicted, you know, geniuses. So,
well, that was kind of his MO, right? I mean, he was this genius that he had brought. He wanted to take the idea of improv and take it from what you did off stage to generate material, and he said, no, we're going to make this the art form that people come to see.
Yeah, he developed that right as I was taking classes with him.
But people also know him to be, you know, a little bit of a recluse, and he did have quite a connection to heavy drug use.
Yeah.
And that affected you.
Yeah, I mean, just the talk of it, you know, just, you know, intrigued me because I was already doing coke and drinking a lot. And so we'd have these tripping parties where he'd, you know, send us out on a quest. You know, everyone in the class would do acid except for like maybe one or two straight actors. And then we'd all meet back at Del's house and talk about the incredible connections of the things we saw. And, you know, we'd get one word, you'd hand out a slip of paper and he'd give you one word. Now follow that word. And then we'd all meet back at his house. And then he would be like, it's genius. And then he'd try to raise Jerry Garcia, you know, from the dead or, you know. It was just all drug-addled bullish, you know.
No, but I mean, that's,
but we thought it was.
But you thought it was great, and you're talking about. I mean, at this time, who? I mean, people that came out of Del Close's tutelage, you, Chris Farley, other people like that who went in and learned how to do improv.
But at the same time, we were alcoholic drug addicts. We latched on to that dark thing. You know that you have to be in pain to create great work. You know what I mean? And so that whole idea touched, you know, only the alcoholic mind or drug addict mind kind of picked up on that message. Mm-hmm. But I remember one time, you know, him saying, you know, the most pure part of art is that line between life and death. So we try to get there. You know what I mean? And, you know, so like the idea of, you know, drug use and alcohol use, you know, was our way to find that dark place, you know.
Now, you took the class with Del, and then you had your success at Second City. You went on to perform on the main stage with a lot of great actors that I mentioned before. You know, but talk about that time, because you were still having issues with drug and alcohol.
Yeah, they were building.
Now you're in front of the lights. Now, you know, their career's on the line. Now there's Saturday Night Live coming to look at you guys. Talk about that experience.
You know, when Joyce came backstage and said, I'm moving you up to the main stage, you know, it was like the best day of my life, because I had been working towards that for, you know, like 5 years. I had toured. I had been at Second City Northwest. It was wonderful. And then, you know, you get into the starting to perform, and then you find that business competition that goes on among your teammates, you know, and some guys are doing well outside doing commercials and already mm-hmm. auditioning for stuff, and I'm putting all my money into, you know, this stage is going to propel me to my goal, SNL, you know. And that was my mistake, was making, you know, one goal, you know.
Yeah, I got to make it here, or this is or self-validation, right?
Right, right. And right. So, you know, SNL would send a group of six or seven reviewers to watch you, and then they'd come like three times, and it'd be whittled down to like three people. In the cast where Tim Meadows and Chris got hired, like there was one really nice guy, but he kept whispering to me, you got really good points. You know, I mean, you're scoring really high. So I'm thinking everything's going to go great, you know. And then they, you know, they meet with me and tell me, you know, we're going to go with Tim and Chris. And if you ever want to call us, you know, give us a call sometime, you know, if you want to maybe submit some scripts, you know. And so it was just this big letdown. And I never thought that wouldn't happen. It's just it's obsessive thinking, or I don't know, you know, how you want to characterize it.
Yeah, obviously at that time, and you had drug and alcohol issues, and obviously the rejection propelled that or continued that, explodes. At what point was rock bottom? What was the point when you said, you know what, man, I got to sober up?
It's 3 years later. You know, I leave downtown. I move in with my dad after my mom dies, and I'm living in his basement. I'm sitting behind a bar as a bartender, you know, and some guy said, you used to be big time, didn't you? Now you're nothing. And getting arrested for crack and stuff like that, and a cop, you know, saying, if you don't go to jail, you're not going to remember this. Slowly but surely, it was just like, my life's going, it's gone. You know what I mean? I hadn't been on stage in 3 years. I get a phone call from my little sister who just begs me to get sober, because I had stolen money from her for crack while she was home for Christmas, and she just calls crying and begs me to get help. And for some reason, she got through to me that day. And I had a bunch of numbers that my dad had gathered from people in recovery, a doctor. I made a call. A week later, I was at Gateway Lake Villa, and then something happened to me while I was up there. I was like, if I don't stay sober, if I don't get this time, I don't have another chance, you know. And like, I wrote a letter to Andrew and asked him for a teaching
Andrew
job.
Andrew Alexander, yeah.
He says, no problem. Marty DeMott, like, just welcomes me in and says, we'll take you through it one class at a time. It'll be fine.
How was it coming back to that experience, coming back to Second City, you know, in a different light, trying to go through recovery?
I always say, you know, I was a terrible teacher, you know. I was, and Marty kept saying, you know, you can't say this to a, you know, to a student. You can't call them stupid, and you can't call them, you know, you can't call them names. And, you know, he just give me back rubs and say, and slowly but surely, it's like, you know, everybody belongs here. You know, got to treat them with love and kindness. Give them positive notes, and then give them a little bit of like what they've done wrong.
You learn how to teach from Del Close. There's a certain genius there, but there's also a rough part there.
Yeah,
you know?
But I had to; those edges had to be worn off.
Yeah, right.
Because I thought my job was to weasel out people who didn't belong on stage. What happens in an improv class is something spiritual, and they get bonded for life.
Right.
And it's a wonderful experience. And a lot of them may not have, you know, those kinds of aspirations to to be on stage or do television or movies or theater or anything. But the idea of, like, Marty, slowly but surely, like, just love, just give them love. They all belong there. They're all one. He turned me into the better teacher because I did come in. I was full of anger. I thought I knew it all. You know, I was like, yeah, I deserve this job back. I was still angry.
I'm back.
It takes a million years to just, you know, dissolve all that anger that I had while I was drinking and drugging, self-hatred and stuff.
So, Tim O'Malley is my guest tonight, longtime Chicago improviser and Second City vet. He was on stage in, at the main stage in the 80s, and now he's teaching. And he's also directing a young group called Scantron, which is performing two shows at the Marty DeMott Theater.
As well as the ongoing show at the Crowd Theater on Thursday nights at 10 p.m. for $5.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about that because you're now in a position where you're putting together, you know, molding young minds to the idea of improv, and you're sort of there, Del Close. So it'd be interesting to get your take on how the roles have reversed for you. Tim O'Malley, my guest tonight on Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight, Tim O'Malley, longtime Second City veteran who is now teaching improv and directing new work from a group called Scantron, which is going to be on stage February 6th and 13th at the Marty DeMott Theater, as well as Thursday nights at 10 o'clock at the Crowd Theater on Broadway. All right, so what does it mean to you to be doing this work, to have a bunch of young people who are wide-eyed and ready to try and put together some comedy? What does it mean for you?
You know what? It reminded me of when I had you guys. Mm-hmm. And do you remember us talking about, like, going out and setting up your own theater?
It's a big thing. A big thing in Second City is they say, don't try to get a job at Second City coming out of the conservatory. Go out, make your name, work in the real world, see what you can do.
A couple years.
And you'll be back.
Right. Right. And if you're good, you know, you'll get busted up by auditions or something like that. Or if you're really good, you'll stay together and form a company like Schadenfreude did.
Right.
Schadenfreude Media.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So Scantron had that. Spencer Catherine Trudel started the group. She's a very strong woman. She's fights for women's rights. So we just added Tori Titmus to the group, very strong woman. And up until then, we had only Spencer and four men. But Spencer was, you know what I mean? She formed the group. She plays strong, powerful women on both sides.
So is it improv or sketch?
It's improv and sketch.
Okay.
But these guys just, you know, they were able to go to dark stuff. And I loved it. And I started to bring it out. So this is a little Del-ish in the sense that I said, you know, nobody's going into, like, the macabre.
You're not in that life and death moment that you guys were sort of trained to be at.
Yeah, well, just like the scenes are getting, like, they're not afraid to play scary or odd or experimental or creatures or dark stuff, you know, dysfunctional families, you know what I mean, and dysfunctional relationships.
As a director, I mean, is it important, that's part of your job as a director to encourage that kind of work, to say,
take a risk. And I brought it out. I'm like, no one's doing this kind of improv. No one's doing kind of weird, scary. You know what I mean? Because a couple of pieces that they've scripted and a couple of pieces they have improvised, like some of the audiences have said, like, that was a little scary tonight. And that's exactly what I want to hear because that was what they did best. So I try to draw that out. So I love working with these guys because I'll just side coach a little bit, like, keep going. You know, there's a sketch they improvised last week about Tinder, guy and a girl on a Tinder date, and they just get so aggressive with each other about comparing how many people they've slept with, that they're red-faced and they're almost, it just gets very dark very fast and kind of sexual tension, you know?
I love the role reversal. I mean, I'm kind of teased that out before the break about the concept of you being, you know, in Del Close's living room to now trying to bring that out of young people. Do you like that role? I mean, is that a role
this
that you're comfortable
happened.
With?
I mean, Scantron came together and brought that to me. You know what I mean? I don't say yes to a lot of groups that ask me to join them. I just love these people. And so it's not what I do normally. It's just what came out of them. And so this is why I really think they're unique. They're different than pretty much anything you're going to see improv-wise because they go so dark. So it's not like I go around looking for groups to turn into like these dark caverns of murderous sexual behavior and stuff. It just happened to come out in this group, and that's why I love them and looking forward to them having great shows.
Do you see yourself having more of a role in directing where you get together with groups? And I mean, is that something you see not only just at groups but when it comes to Second City, like getting more involved in direction as opposed to just teaching?
I would like to, but they have a directing program, and they really like the younger guys coming up, you know, to go through the directing program and stuff like that. But I do enjoy the fact that, like, a young comedy group could come to me and we could develop something together.
It's Tim O'Malley's my guest tonight here on The Download. Let's take a break for the news. We'll come back. I want to ask you about some of the issues that are happening in improv. I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of activity surrounding the idea that this is really a male-dominated field, and it's coming out
there.
It's not. Well, we'll talk more about it. We'll come back over the news. I want to get your take on some of the issues that are happening in Chicago. Tim O'Malley, my guest tonight on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight, Tim O'Malley. Tim O'Malley, longtime improviser, actor, comedian, instructor, now director.
Professional clown.
Tim, really, I mean, you made your name as a main stage actor, but you also had your show, God Show, which was in 2003, which I want to talk about.
Some guy's trying to get me to do it on Broadway.
Really?
Yeah, so we'll see how that
goes.
Well,
I mean, what's great about it is it's a show that you wrote about your time in addiction and recovering from it, and it's called God Show because, you know, you say the reason you were able to stay sober, and you've been sober coming up on 20 years, congratulations, is because of God.
Yeah.
How so?
You know, it's hard to explain to people that don't have any faith. I mean, maybe they're, you know, they believe in humankind and stuff like that. But, you know, what recovery allows you to do is to nurture your spirituality. It's not religious. It's definitely just the idea of, like, something out there is helping me. And it's as simple as for me to understand that, like, I would have never gotten hired at Second City unless Cheryl Sloan and a couple other people that liked me opened the door for me. Like, I didn't get hired by Second City. I was allowed in. Someone opened the door. That whole idea of, like, I didn't get this on my own. Doors open for you by the universe, whatever you want to call it. So, like, that was my beginning, like, concept. And then the idea, like, that I could stop was just completely out of my thought process before, you know, 2 weeks before I got into treatment. And then 6 months out after some steps in recovery and stuff like that, I was free of the obsession. I wasn't thinking about it anymore. Yeah. It wasn't even in my head. And I had tools to stop, you know, whenever I thought about picking up or whatever. And I had help, and you get tons of help. And that's what, you know, support is all about.
You know,
about.
For you, I mean, you spent so much time in circles with Del Close and with Second City and that sort of sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of environment.
In Burton Place,
right. That lifestyle leads itself, even now. I mean, it leads itself to let's go to the bar afterwards. You know what? Let's experiment with drugs, you know, drugs and sex and rock and roll, the whole bit, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's really, it's almost all of comedy is based on this idea that it happens after midnight. I mean, there's something to it. So how do you, as a recovering addict who has come back to the art form, how do you keep yourself clear from the trappings of that so many comedians fall into?
You know, I just go home.
good advice. Go home, everybody.
You know, the idea of my students in the first few years used to say, you should come over to the Old Town Ale House with us. And I'd say, you know, I don't drink anymore. Or I'd say, you know, you wouldn't want to see what happens if I drank, you know. And so, but it's really funny that no one asks me anymore. I don't know if it's detoxed a lot out of casts, it, you know, out of certain places. But there is that concept. But plumbers say that, you know, hey, this is a working guy's world. You go to the bar and then you go home. You know, or, you know, lawyers
right,
say that.
Right.
Oh, you know, I get a lot of work done at the bar. You know, I make a lot of, you know, like, and it's all total garbage. Because they think, you know, oh, I have to be around. I have to rub elbows. But we know people who rubbed elbows with famous people and they never got anywhere and they ended up dead. And the famous people ended up dead. You know what I mean? And the whole idea that you have to, you know, imbibe. Like, nobody gives a crap what you're drinking if you sit at a bar anyway.
Right. Let me ask you this.
And surely you can walk away from any drug use if you have the will.
We're talking with Tim O'Malley here, a longtime Second City vet who's directing a show, a group called Scantron, which is at the Marty DeMott Theater February 6th and the 13th. There's been a lot going on. I mean, it's always kind of been known in Chicago and in improv and comedy as it's sort of a male-dominated field, that men, white men, just dominate and almost just overtake everything else when it comes to improv. You go to see IO or you go to Second City, it's always white dudes just everywhere.
Diversity. There's more and more
how is that coming? Because
gender equality going on At least at Second City, there is.
So,
you know, some casts recently have been more women than men at Second City. I mean, they're really working at, you know, combating that and changing the thought process. I mean, I think ever since Tina Fey, Amy Poehler had books out, it's really influenced the young comedic female mind. And my classes are, in large part, more women than men most of the time now. As far as, you know, misogyny and mistreatment of women, you know, inside casts. I know, you know, it stems from this ancient thought of, you know, women aren't funny.
Yeah, it comes from, and this is a well-reported story that, you know, there's a sect or area of improv and comedy where some men believe that women just aren't funny.
Yeah, but it's an ancient poison.
Ironically,
tell
it
me
does,
that Amy Poehler doesn't make you, you know, pee in your pants every
does
time
come,
she comes up with a character.
Back to the founding geniuses, and one of them being Del Close. You know, from the top down, when you talk about the philosophy of improv and the people who taught it, he was one of these leaders who said no.
That was just because he got burned by a couple of women that he loved, you know what I mean? And that's just my opinion. And so he started to spread stuff. I mean, even in Something Wonderful Right Away, you know, he spoke about Joan Rivers being a bad improviser, and we used to, people used to use it in class as like an example of bad improv, and it never happened. I listened to hours and hours of tapes for editing the Second City Almanac book, you know, mm-hmm. and Joan Rivers was hysterical, and she was a great improviser, and she was very, very funny, you know, and Elaine May was funny as hell. And, you know, from what I know, he was in love with both those people, you know. And the story is that, you know, in the scene in, what's the movie, Dustin Hoffman, Mrs. Robinson, remember he's pounding on the window going, Elaine, Elaine, Elaine.
Yeah.
That comes from the true story of, you know, Del stalking Elaine's wedding.
Is that true? I never knew that.
Yeah, because the director was Mike Nichols.
Yeah, Mike Nichols.
So
there's a site that's coming out that women are able to anonymously tell of their stories of being in cast, being approached after shows, having misogyny and frankly harassment happen at the hands of men in the improv community. And not just the improv community, but in the stand-up comedy community, in the sketch comedy community, just essentially the comedy community here in Chicago. And a lot of people are going to social media to talk about their stories, to open up. But what it really does, it shines a light on something that has been happening in Chicago for decades. But you say it's getting better. And frankly,
I think it is. I mean, you guys had great women in Schadenfreude.
Kate, I had one woman, yeah.
Yeah, and there was never and loved and respected her because she was funny, talented, yeah. and a strong woman. I mean, I think what we need to instill and continue to instill in all our students is respect. I think all we can do is just keep promoting the idea of like strong women, you know, speak out, teaching guys, you know, treat women, you know, equally.
You know, on stage, I mean, to be a great improviser, to be a great comedian, respect is a big part of it. And you know that. You taught me that. And the idea of what happens off stage is, you know, respect and how
yeah, but
about
I,
you
I
being
I cover
a person.
That in
yeah,
class.
Right.
I'm like, you know, if you want to bitch about the show, go to the bar. You know, I mean, but and how you treat each other before and after a show is really important. Like right before a show, keep the back, you know, stage area clear of any of your outside garbage. You know, no one's got the right to say that sucked or you sucked. You know, to take that to someone else away from the place. Mm-hmm. I try to cover all that stuff, etiquette. Like Donnie DiPolo used to teach us, you know, he used to tell us all about before and after is just as important. You know, none of this emailing each other and giving each other notes. And, you know, now we got social media and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I can imagine that people get abused or someone gets said something about.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to include that when they get in the upper levels, you know.
Let me ask you this, Tim. You know, you've been a part of the comedy community for a long time now. I mean, you talked about getting into class in 1979, 1980. You know, how has it changed over time? I mean, do you feel like, you know, it's the same as sort of like it was at the Earl of Old Town? Or do you feel like we've evolved in 2016?
Well, everything changes. You know, what we thought was funny, it was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. It's like classic writing. There's a difference between a sketch that's going to last for a long time or a television show that's going to last. And you and I, being writers and comedians, can spot it. We can go, this is classic writing. This mm-hmm. is a great show. You know, I'm going to watch this. And so the idea of trying to teach young people how to think in a classic way, how, you know, start thinking in terms of classic writing so it's timeless. you know, if it's not a satirical piece based on something current event, try to write pieces that will last, that you could do, or characters you can do for a long
forever,
time.
Yeah, right.
So it's really important to try to get that across. But when someone's stuck on the newest popular craze because they fall in love with something that's their age or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, they'll say, you know, I love this show or that show. And I'll say, have you ever seen, you know, this? And they're like, no, I've never seen that. Like a young writing student, I asked her if she ever heard of Joss Whedon. And she said, no, I don't know who that is.
How's what? That's young. I thought you were going to say Larry Gelbart or something. Like Joss Whedon, come on. That's...
When I said there's university classes being taught about how he changed television to kind of classic television. They consider him like the father of new television.
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, have you ever seen Buffy or Angel or any of those things? Because it's like comedy, drama, and dark. And she's like, no, I haven't. You know, it's hard to explain to someone. You know, I had a student who thought, who was the guy that was running around making fun of people?
That's a lot of different people.
Sasha.
Oh, Sasha Baron Cohen. Yeah.
Right. And the student was like, he's a genius. You know, he's going to be around forever. And I'm like, well, he's doing his humor at the expense of other people. And this is going to die. And I can't explain to you why walking around and making fun of other people isn't like Jackass. I mean, there are people that like it. But when you're 15 years old, what you like. And when you're 25
when you're 30,
or something,
right,
you like. So to answer your question, and what you're 35... You know, you start to get this sense of what's going to last, you know?
Tim O'Malley is a longtime Second City veteran and main stage actor who now is a teacher and a director. He's directing the group Scantron Improv and Sketch, which will be February 6th and the 13th at the Marty DeMott Theater. And they're also up at the Crowd Theater on Broadway Thursday nights at 10. Tim, thanks for coming in. Thanks for talking about your
great
story.
To have, great
good to see
be
you.
Here. Great to talk to you, Justin. It's great to see you.
It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, talk with Louder Than the Bombs, Kevin Colville, DJ Lord. Have a student in here. Talk about what it's like to be a part of Louder Than the Bomb. The one of the best things going in Chicago every year. This is the 16th year. And also, it's the largest youth poetry festival in the country, if not the world. I don't know who does it. But great alumni. People have come out. An amazing tradition in Chicago. So we're going to talk about that coming up at 9 o'clock. Rick Hahn's going to join us. We're going to talk about Chicago White Sox baseball. I'm excited for the Sox, although I was more excited last year when they got Melky Cabrera and Adam LaRoche and all these guys. I'm like, they got an idea. They're going to win 100 games. And they won 75, and everybody loved the Cubs. But this year I'm a little bit more tempered.
Yeah,
I think what's happening
is,
think last year it was the 2005 World Championship anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're like, oh, it's going to be fun. Ozzie Guillen's going to be there. And now you're like, all right, you didn't win. You didn't play well. And now you're in a situation where it's been, what, one time in 10 years that the White Sox have gone to the playoffs?
2008?
Yeah, they lost.
The
and it was a playoff, like a one-off. So, yeah, I got to get some work done. Hey, so we'll talk about that. And then also coming up, the frying pan tonight. Steve Gadlin is back. I know
so
everybody's
good.
Ready, man. I know everybody's ready. Last week was great. The me first.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was just all over Gadlin. He is shields up. he was deflecting. So, yes. So, this week, he says he's got the best idea yet. So, we'll see. 312-981-7200. What do you got going on this weekend? You going to watch the Super Bowl?
Yeah, of course.
You a Super Bowl guy?
I wouldn't put that on my bumper sticker.
Did you watch it 30 for 30 last night? Did you make it and watch it?
Yes, of course. Bears.
I felt like when I was done, I went to Twitter and I'm like, I just need to join the conversation.
And there one?
No, there wasn't one. There was a lot about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, something, there really wasn't much about the 30 for 30 and the Bears.
I was walking home, and it was on already. I was walking home about 8:30 or something because we got off early. And I walked by this local bar, and they had it on in there. I'm like, oh, man, everybody's watching it.
the whole world
is watching it. And then you watch it, and it was like, yeah, I know all this stuff.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know, the 85 Bears, as the joke we were making all week, is, wow, they finally got a documentary. They're finally going to tell their story. They've told their story. And I think what we were hoping for from an ESPN 30 for 30 was to go, you know, go deep.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's for a national audience and a lot of that stuff. Like, it was classic, Dick. You know, we played Dolphins. It was tough. We lost. You know, like that kind of stuff. And now we played another team. We beat them. We knew we could beat them. All right. But the end was good.
Yeah.
I had a hard time. I told everybody before the show that I was trying to get my son to watch it with me, 8 years old, because I was like, oh. And he did. Because the idea of staying up late.
That appeals to him.
Because there was no school today. So there was, you know, like, I was like, okay, he can stay up till 10. And we can watch this. And it appealed to him to stay up late. But then he quickly realized that that meant he'd have to watch this documentary that he cared nothing about. Nothing. I mean, this is 8 years old.
Yeah, no.
And I was trying. I was like, look at how big the fridge is. Look at how fun. Look, they did Coca-Cola commercials.
Nothing.
And he's like, and it's true. Like, none of it is, I guess that's the thing. Like, it's like none of it is that, like, audacious in 2016. They did a bunch of commercials. They were worldwide. You know, the Punky QB. I'm like, yeah, because he wrote marker on his own headband because he got in trouble. You can't wear a D. All right. That guy right there in the wheelchair, he's a big defensive coach. Like, just nothing was like.
And then the one thing I kept pushing
was the Super Bowl shuffle's coming up. Super Bowl, they glossed over it.
Yeah, they showed the cover of the record. That's about all.
Which I'm glad they did because it's so overblown. But it was like, that was the one thing I thought I could hook him.
Yeah.
I thought maybe, you know, like, oh, look, they're dancing. It's funny. Didn't care.
So. Couldn't hook him with the Vince Vaughn narration.
I didn't realize that was him until about halfway through.
Yeah.
And then I saw that it was Peter Billingsley was also producer on it. So it was like, it was the same crew that does Swingers and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So they had something to do with that, huh? Yeah, it was interesting. I'm looking forward to what Rich does, Rich Lenkoff and Otis Wilson with us, because Otis told some great stories to us here on the download, you know, that he wasn't in this, so it'd be interesting to see.
I think over the next few weeks, I think we're going to get a couple of 85 Bears in here.
Oh.
McMichael, I think, is coming.
Oh,
the Colonel, Richard Dent.
I can't. I'm no words.
So.
There's so much I want to talk to him about.
Dig a little deeper.
I want to talk to Richard Dent about the sack he had in the San Francisco 49ers. Later, it was like 87, 88 before he left. He didn't retire with the Bears. He played a couple more years, didn't he? Where he just went, he like launched himself over like he was like Superman. And he got the quarterback by the ankles. Like just watching him in that some of those shots last night, you're like, that's a defensive end.
Yeah.
There are no defensive ends like that. They changed the model. The model now is, like, fast. You know, Julius Peppers is probably the same size, but, you know, the idea is to be a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Dent, though, man, there's nothing. I mean, he's like the guy who was in Buffalo, Bruce Smith, that kind of thing. You know, like that, those big defensive ends. And Richard Dent was just, wow, amazing.
J.J. Watt comes
right,
to mind.
J.J. Watt.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the only
Texans.
One. Yeah, it feels like he's, like, the one. But yeah, it's so good. Did you watch it last night, Rob?
I didn't.
You don't care. You're a Pittsburgh guy.
Well, no. Look, man. I grew up in Chicago. I'm a Bears guy. I was at a club on Rush Street with a friend of mine and his father when they won the Super Bowl.
Oh, they probably had shots of you. That was one of the only things I liked watching, and that my son actually paid attention to. I'm like, look how funny people dressed back then.
Yeah.
Mustache.
I had my parachute pants on. I had my thin tie going. Oh, yeah. Hair was feathered down the middle. Man, I was styling.
773 just texted and said the OJ movie was more revealing than the 85 Bears doc.
I always get irritated. There's a friend of mine who, you know, the 85 Bears, everybody loves the 85. And people from here especially, that's the best team of all, best Super Bowl team of all time, best NFL team of all time. But this guy's like, 72 Dolphins.
That Bears team, though, guys, you know, looking back and now that I'm older and I can reflect on it, that really was two separate teams.
Yeah, that's what
talked
about.
The offensive side.
You didn't even watch the documentary. Look at you. Look at you, Martyr. You know? You should have been the narrator. Vince Vaughn, take a seat. That's what the whole thing was about, that they didn't even talk to each other. There was a defensive side and offensive side. And Buddy Ryan and Mike Dickett didn't even share game plans and things. They just did it. That's great. I wish it was that. Yeah. And that's why they both were carried off at the end. They're two different coaches. We all need heroes, man. Oh, I could listen to that track all night. Just keep going over and over.
Please.
All right. So coming up a little bit later, Steve Gadlin's here, the frying pan. Also, we're going to talk with Rick Hahn, the general manager of the Chicago White Sox, about what to expect from the team this year. They won 73 games in 2014, 76 in 2015. So that means 110 in 2016, right? I think I did the right math. They'll talk to Rick about the expectations for the club. But first, coming up next weekend, Chicago will be teaming with young, aspiring poets and performers as they take part in what has become a proud tradition. Louder Than a Bomb is a citywide poetry festival put on by young Chicago authors. It's crazy successful. It's one of the most positive events created for Chicago youth in generations. And it sports a who's who of alumni: Chance the Rapper, Saba, Donnie Trumpet, Mick Jenkins, and several of the rising stars on the hip-hop scene today. The man who co-created the festival's here tonight, Kevin Kovels, Chicago poet and co-editor of the Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip-Hop. He's also the artistic director of Young Chicago Authors. Good to see you, Kevin.
Hey, man. Thanks for having us here.
Also in studio with me tonight, Antoine Funches. He's a senior at Simeon High School who's performing in the festival. He's also the indie champ from last year. Antoine, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to hear from DJ Lord. He's going to be on the show in just a moment. But first, let's start. Kevin, 16th year. I mean, this festival is a teenager.
Yeah, yeah. And it, you know, it needs to shower more often. but it's figuring itself out. You know, it's starting to, like, get a little bravado. I could drive now, and we're excited. We're really excited about this year.
What I mean, take us back to 2000. I mean, the difference, sort of juxtapose that time to now. I mean, in 2000, you're talking about let's introduce a program almost like to the public schools to what it is now, which is, I mean, the final show's at the Auditorium Theater.
Yeah, and that's what it was. I mean, it was an idea that we had that we were like, let's do this evening. You know, let's do this one night. And now, I mean, the festival is 5 weeks long, and it really represents year-round work we do in the schools on a regular basis. We work with thousands and thousands of young people, hundreds of schools throughout the course of the year. And I think the main difference I've seen is that in 2000, 2001, when we started the festival, the culture of Chicago for young people was what the culture popularly is now. Even it was radically segregated, and now I think in part because of Louder Than a Bomb and because of hip hop cultural practice, I think young people now traverse the city in a new way, mm-hmm. beyond boundaries that city
That's
planners
so
keep them in.
And it's true, because we just talked to Saba, who was on the show, and he talked about going up to young Chicago authors or going to the Harold Washington Library and meeting. That's where this younger generation of hip-hop artists that are taking their headlining Pitchfork and on the Stephen Colbert show, that's where they're coming from. They're coming from, you know, going to poetry slams and reads and taking classes at Young Chicago Authors.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think we believe that the city and its institutions, whether they want to or not, are for its young people. And so we've tried our best to open those spaces and also just to create meetups and communities around the city where young people don't have the typical boundaries that are placed upon them or that are placed upon their parents, and, you know, try to use the tool of storytelling, the tool of spoken word, of hip-hop poetry in order to, you know, create a larger, fresher, more radically diverse community.
All right, Antoine, why'd you get involved?
I got involved in Louder Than a Bomb because as an eighth grader, I always wrote raps. It was the only way that classmates ever paid attention to me. When I got in high school, it was a poetry team in my school, and I joined that, and boom, Louder Than a Bomb. It's like, couldn't escape it after that. I had to come back, had to keep doing it, had to keep growing, and it's grown me into who I am.
Let me ask you, because, you know, you mentioned in eighth grade, you know, writing raps.
Yeah.
When you were young, did you consider yourself, you were writing raps or you were writing poetry?
I didn't know what poetry was. When I heard poetry, I thought people in dressed in all black snapping in a room to things that don't make sense. And it still doesn't make sense as much. But no, I didn't at all consider myself a poet. I just thought I'm this angry kid who listens to a lot of angry music, and bam.
So let me ask you, you know, when you got to high school and there was a poetry club and you started working with the poetry club and then you discovered Louder Than a Bomb, what do you think of poetry now?
I think poetry is a Rosetta Stone. I think it's not the only way. I think it's probably the best way that I know to communicate with other people, other classes, and just people of different backgrounds. I can translate politics, emotions, life experiences, anything that I've been through or I know about, and I can put it in a form that's entertaining for you to get it, even though you're from the other side of the country.
Antoine Funches is a senior at Simeon High School here in Chicago. Kevin Colville's the artistic director of Young Chicago Authors. He's also the co-creator of this festival. Let's take a break. Let's take the break now, because when we come back, I want to bring in DJ Lord, DJ from Public Enemy. Big part of why you even started Louder Than a Bomb, Public Enemy, and you know, obviously, talk before we go to break, tell us why Public Enemy is so special to Louder Than a Bomb.
Well, one, just Chuck D as a poet, as a lyricist, as an organizer and an activist really motivated me as a young writer, and then particularly the festival's named after a Public Enemy song on their second record, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. We named the festival after the towers had fallen and the country was paranoid and criminalizing brown people around the planet, and we wanted to use youth culture to have a counter narrative to that paranoia and criminalization. And so we grabbed the title of a Public Enemy song. And every year we give out the Chuck D Award for Lyrical Terrorism. And so this year he'll be presenting the
How
award in
that,
his namesake.
Man.
Yeah, we're
is that great? Come on, man.
Yeah, no, we're excited. we're very excited.
All right, Kevin, Antoine, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, DJ Lord will join the conversation. Stay with us. There we go. It's a download here on WGN Radio. We're talking Louder Than a Bomb, which kicks off next weekend and goes all the way, 5 weeks, goes all the way to March 19th, is it? March 19th at the Auditorium will be the finals. On March 18th at the Metro, you're going to have a sort of Sweet 16 party, or it's, you know, I think that's what it's called, right? Or it's
it's kind of our gala, just an opportunity to celebrate not only the radical, amazing young people in Chicago and the culture that they're creating here, but also this year we're honoring Chuck D and DJ Lord.
So this is great because so everyone out there, just so we set it up, Louder Than a Bomb is essentially like a poetry slam tournament. I mean, the different schools and teams from all over the city come together. You have preliminaries throughout February into March, and then the teams are picked and selected down to a final, which is going to be at the Auditorium.
Yeah, the final four will go to the Auditorium Theater. I mean, we have this year we'll probably have about 120, 130 teams. And so it's like the Illinois State basketball tournament meets 8 Mile meets.
I know this festival because I've covered it for before, and you're right. It started with like maybe what?
A handful.
Four teams?
A handful of teams.
Five teams?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Kevin Colville's the artistic director of the Young Chicago Authors. He's a co-creator of Louder Than a Bomb. Antoine Funches is also in studio. He's a senior at Simeon High School, and he's going to perform a little bit for us in just a second. Before we do that, let's bring in DJ Lord. DJ Lord, DJ for Public Enemy. A big part, I mean, he's going to be honored at the Metro on the 18th. Public Enemy, a huge part of Louder Than a Bomb. DJ Lord, welcome to the download.
Thanks, guys. What's going on?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. You know, when approached to do this, to be a part of Louder Than a Bomb, this poetry festival in Chicago, tell us why you chose to be a part of it.
Well, I chose to be a part of it, speaking to Chuck, because it's a reflection of myself. Coming out of Savannah, I mean, making a way out of no way with no outlets, and my voice was music. You know, there was nothing. I did everything to so-called make it or to be heard in Savannah. I did from the club DJ to mixtapes to local groups to everything, and I just hit a brick wall. And it wasn't until I chose to move to another city and start that same grind, again, that I met up with Professor Griff. And, you know, fast forward to 2016, here I'm with Public Enemy with, you know, being seen, being heard with a voice.
Right.
So I see, I mean, Chicago and abroad, I see places that are just, you know, with the youth that have no voice and they don't have an outlet. And, you know, they start choosing wrong directions and it just ends up in a bad situation. So I took it to heart.
Let me ask you, because Antoine, you know, he talked about being in eighth grade and being able to be, sort of recognized for writing raps. And he didn't think of it as poetry. He thought about sort of the idea of just writing raps. For you, you know, being a DJ and being immersed in hip hop culture your entire life, talk about the idea of names and what they call things, as you're coming up.
It's just it's just a vent. That's my title for it. Some people say, you know, just jotting down some notes. Some people say just making some beats when you get off work. Some people say just trying to come up with some type of scratches or something. It was a vent. And my thing is, you name it later. Put it out there, name it later. You know, they call it, it's the expression. It's a release.
Hey, peace, DJ Lord. This is Kevin Koval with the Young Chicago Authors, the artistic director here. Peace. We have not met, but first of all, we are honored and incredibly excited to have you in Chicago on March 18th and March 19th. So first of all, thank you so much, man. You and Chuck for coming to make the trip here. Really appreciate y'all.
No worries, man. No worries. No worries at all. You know, it's going to be great.
Oh, man. We are turned and really looking forward to building with y'all. I guess a question, you know, we spent a lot of time in Chicago talking about our literary heritage. And you know, we trace ourselves to, you know, prominently Gwendolyn Brooks and Haki Madhubuti and Carolyn Rogers and folks who came before us to get us to this moment. I'm curious about your musical legacies and where do you take, you know, kind of notes from and what musicians really inspired you to create and play music?
Coming up, listening to music from my uncles, it was Gil Scott-Heron on Sundays. It was Sam Cooke and my mom cooking breakfast in the morning. It was just always around family that had that influence. And like I said, if it wasn't Gil Scott-Heron, it was jazz. It was Miles. It was in the Philly connection. So I get my influences from multi levels, multi genres, and it was based all in family. And I took the baton, so to speak, and just ran with it.
You know, let me ask you, DJ Lord, before we let you go. I mean, the idea that this festival in Chicago is bringing so many different kids. I mean, we just talked about how it went from, you know, 40 kids to thousands of kids and teams and all these things coming together for a positive experience here in Chicago. And it's really because of what Public Enemy, you know, I mean, Kevin's relationship listening and being inspired by Public Enemy. What does that mean for you as part of that group as to know that in a different city there's this movement that's happening because of the music that you create?
Makes me excited. I'm still a fan. I'm still a fan of Public Enemy. I mean, I grew up on Public Enemy. I joined in 1998, replacing Terminator X, and, you know, coming out of Savannah to Atlanta, coming out of the 9 to 5 thing, basically straight to a show in Belgium with no rehearsal, 15,000 people festival, and pressures all around, messing up left and right. But I was always inspired, and I'd already knew Terminator stuff like the back of my hand. So, you know, it was just a matter of time before I'd gotten it. But it makes me smile that there are people that feel the same way that I do.
Yeah,
I still call Chuck my hero, even though now I'm the pilot of the group. I still look at it from a fan's perspective. So even though I've been with the group since 98, it still feels like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
It's still an adventure. It's still a go get them attitude. It's still, when we get in the studio, it's still, you know, we got to make this track. This track got to scream this. It has to say this. It has to break down. It has to make me feel this way because I felt that way.
DJ Lord is the DJ and turntablist for Public Enemy. And you and Chuck D will be coming to Chicago for the gala, the Louder Than the Bomb gala on March 18th at the Metro. DJ Lord, thanks for taking some time out tonight. We appreciate it.
No worries, man. See you guys later.
Yes, sir. Look forward to it.
All right, there you go. I love it, man. I mean, sometimes it's just on. Like you're talking to a DJ for Public Enemy. That's so cool.
Yeah,
Kevin Koval in studio. Also, Antoine Funches. All right. Antoine, senior from Simeon High School. He was the indie champ last year from Louder Than the Bomb, and he's going to give us a sample of what we might hear from Louder Than the Bomb this year. Antoine Funches, the mic is yours.
This poem is called Literary Analysis. I sit in English class. May as well be sitting in How to Idolize the English Class. British Lit has never had me lit, just had me sit, read about a white protagonist. The main character is most likely a Christian who has access to limitless adventures because of their privilege. Reading Narnia, and I've got to say the wardrobe doesn't suit me. How is it that the book is diverse enough to feature woodland creatures, talking beavers, but citizens of the one Muslim kingdom worship a demon? The only two citizens who aren't considered fiendish are Princess Erevis, who runs off with a white boy, a.k.a. Treason, and a guard who converts to worship Aslan the Lion, a.k.a. Feline Jesus. In Curtis Sittenfeld's Prep, the character Darden is described as the class's cool black guy. He dark, he tall, he straight from the Bronx. His skin be synonymous with his basketball. He even got a gold chain to show his enslavement to a white author's pen and page. Everyone has seen the movie Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but who knew that in the novels, Oompa Loompas were chocolate-colored African slaves? Every paragraph I pick makes me feel degraded, but I must read every page because I will be graded. Education system worried about my race's progress reports. May I report on the education system's lack of racial progress? Because I've spent 12 years reading the same plots about private schools. The same ones being built while my public education is capitalized. This poem is for every minority whose house on Mango Street is being gentrified, for those who feel like runaways and see slave catchers in the rye, yearning to put the heads of pig-headed authors on a stick like the Lord of the Flies. Classic literature be the classic hall pass for white pride and prejudice, make readers as colorblind as Oedipus. If we live in a post-racial time, why is the clockwork still orange? Can we read Chimamanda Adichie? She tells how not to stereotype and the danger of a single story. So maybe we can start learning about Latino glory instead of thinking Mexico is some hellhole lying south of the border. Or maybe Angela Davis, so she can tell how prisons are obsolete, so black and brown kids wouldn't think that the penitentiary is the only thing that awaits them in these streets. Or maybe Amy Tan could show the opposite of faith, so people who haven't seen members of the opposite race would have an image of diversity that diverges from a token minority friend, and black and brown kids could relate and would need spark notes just to comprehend, and then maybe, just maybe, I wouldn't feel three-fifths of a human after reading just three-fifths of a novel. Thank you.
Hey, there you go. All right.
Yeah, come on, man.
How about that? That was great, man.
Thank you.
Antoine Funches, a senior at Simeon High School. He's part of the, he was the indie champ last year at Louder Than the Bomb. You're performing again this year?
Yes, I am.
Are you excited? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You sound ready.
Got all the
like
poems ready.
Kevin, what can we expect from this year's tournament?
Well, I think narratives like that. I think narratives that counter our ideas about what young people are doing in the city. I think that, you know, I mean, Antoine is representative in a lot of ways of what will be heard on stage, and it's everything. It's the spectrum of human experience.
Where do we find it?
I mean, go to youngchicagoauthors.org. You know, you could get at us on social media at Young Shy Authors. At Kevin Koval on Twitter. I keep using the hashtag LTAB2016 just to inform people about the events. Mm-hmm. We start February 13th. It's the first day of the festival. It's only for the participants. And then that following week, we start the preliminary bouts. Our longtime partner, Columbia College Chicago, a lot of our events are there, but they're throughout the city, Roosevelt. And then, the finals, March 19th, are at the Auditorium Theater.
Auditorium Theater.
And our big gala this year, our fundraiser for the whole festival, is at Metro Chicago. Jill Shanahan, who's on our board, is a longtime supporter. We're honoring Chuck D and the radical culture of youth and young people in this city, and it's going to be quite an evening that night.
Kevin Koval is the artistic director of Young Chicago Authors. He co-created the festival Louder Than a Bomb. He's also the co-editor of The Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip Hop. Antoine Funches is a senior at Simeon High School. He won the Indie Champion last year, and he's performing in the festival this year. Guys, thanks for being here. Good luck with the festival.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Let's go, 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 White Sox. Chicago's proud of you.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Chicago White Sox campaign in 2015 was an improvement over 2014. They went from 73 wins to 76. So what does that mean for 2016? Well, there's a couple new faces in the infield, second and third base exclusively, and there are rumors that the Sox are still interested in adding an outfielder. But what about that pitching staff? Ha! So many questions for the Southsiders who report to camp later this month. Joining me tonight, Rick Hahn, the general manager for the Chicago White Sox. Rick, thanks for taking some time out tonight.
No, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Justin.
So let's start. You know, there's been a lot of talk about you adding to the White Sox team, or rumors flying around outfielders. Are you looking to add depth through free agency to the outfield?
You know, there has been a ton of rumors for the last several weeks, and I think that's probably a little bit of a ripple effect of the fact that we're trying to be as diligent as we can not to leave any stone unturned as we head into spring training here. And if there's a possibility of getting better, whether it's in the outfield, the infield, the pitching staff, you can know that we've had at least one, if not multiple, conversations with certain targets. The fact is we did have a lot of optimism around this club a year ago at this time, given the changes we made last offseason. Obviously, the year did not play out anywhere close to not only the way we thought it was going to, but the way much of baseball anticipated how we were going to play. So we went out and made the additions you referenced with Todd Frazier at third and Brett Laurie at second, and upgraded what we feel from an offensive standpoint, our catching situation.
Yeah.
And we feel like we're in a better position today than we were a year ago. But in all candor, we don't feel like we're done. We feel like there's additional upgrade or upgrades that can potentially be made. And until opening day or until we make those moves, we're gonna stay on it looking to get better.
Does it frustrate you? I mean, in this day and age with all the media and the social media being able to attach the White Sox to so many different free agents and whether or not that's actually true, if that's the agent's work or if that's a reporter just sort of, you know, speculating. Does it frustrate you the way the media has the White Sox attached to, it seems like, every single free agent that's out there?
You know, yes and no. From a trying to be cognizant of the world we live in and respectful of those professionals who cover this club and the fans who are passionate about it. Like, I get it. It's interesting. It's provocative. It keeps you warm thinking of summer through a cold winter. And if I weren't in the position I'm in right now, I'd be following it on Twitter or whatever social media I preferred as diligently as everyone else is who cares about the Sox. From a White Sox general manager standpoint, yeah, it's frustrating. It because a lot of the time it's inaccurate, simply because obviously sources are imperfect, or their information is imperfect at least, and we're not in a position to really respond. I think we're far, far more effective when people don't know exactly what we're up to. The fact of the matter is not only some of the targets over the last several years, but specifically some that we converted on this offseason were coveted by other clubs within our division. And having them know that we were lurking on them, if they had, was only going to make acquiring them more difficult.
Right.
So from a ability to get work done standpoint, it's frustrating. From realizing this is the world we're now in and that it's interesting to Sox fans who care about the club, I get it. It's just reality now.
You know, as a Sox fan, one of the things last year that was frustrating from an offensive standpoint, you guys put together quite a free agent haul, bringing in Melky, mm-hmm. bringing in Adam LaRoche, others who were going to make this a dynamite offensive lineup. That didn't necessarily come to fruition. And then on top of it, you know, at times on the field, the defense was pretty atrocious. Like you had a lot of problems and shuffling people left and right and all over the place. Talk about how you improved on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, you know, when we went out, I have to say you're correct that with your initial assessment that the biggest issue we had was the run scoring. When we went out to improve that this offseason, though, we wanted to remain aware of the fact that we did have some defensive struggles. The fact of the matter is if you're scoring 5, 6, 7 runs a night versus 2, 3, 4 runs a night, you can tolerate some of those occasional defensive miscues. But the way our offense put our entire club, our pitching staff, our defense in the position where we were scrapping through every game, we had so many one-run losses that every little defensive miscue was magnified,
right.
made things difficult. So when we went out this year, the number one goal was to upgrade the offense, and then we feel like we've done that with the additions of Frazier and Laurie and Navarro Avila, not to mention some of the expected bounce back from some of those additions from last offseason that you referenced that have mm-hmm. track records of being solid offensive contributors. At the same time, we couldn't just turn a blind eye to the defense. And when having essentially three-quarters of a new infield with Frazier, Saladino, and Laurie from third, short, and second, we feel we're going to be a lot stronger in that regard as well. Todd's one of the finer all-around third basemen in the game. He's more known for, you know, his home run derby triumphs as well as his offensive prowess, but he's a very solid defensive player, and Saladino's just a smart old-school baseball player who's going to pick up the ball and make the smart play and get the outs as we need in the infield, and Laurie's another guy who's not only a good all-around player but brings energy and we think a little element that was missing last year.
All right, Rick, let me ask you the hard questions now.
Okay. I'm ready.
this is the one that, as a Sox fan, you know, the team has been starting slow. Aprils have not been that great under Coach Ventura. The problem means that there's a lot of catch-up that has to happen. There's just been a tremendous amount of anticipation for this team that falls short. What are you doing to make sure that the Sox start fast? And if they don't start fast, are we going to continue to hear, you know, you're going to continue to hear the chorus from White Sox fans is it the manager? So the question right. for me is just like, what do you do to safeguard about starting fast? And if you don't start fast and you find yourself 6, 7, 8 games back to the Royals or the Tigers, that's not good for the White Sox.
No, that's not good for anybody. And the fact is you're 100% right about the way we've gotten out of the gate the last few years. And it's even with, I think, having the best or second best record in baseball last year between June 30th and July 30th right. leading up to the trade deadline, we had dug ourselves such a hole that even once we were playing up to or perhaps even beyond our true ability, we just left ourselves too much of a uphill battle for the rest of the season. So we've been talking about this going back to, I'd say, probably August, about ways to put us at least in the best position to succeed early in the season, whether that's from a different use of the roster composition, whether we have more pitching or less pitching or better platoon options for Robin heading into the year so he's able to play matchups from day one. Is something we've discussed, but we've also talked about the importance of spring training and the fact that from day one of this year, not only are we going to be focused on the traditional fundamentals that you hear and see clubs do every spring, but prioritizing doing things right and winning ball games early. I think you're probably going to see our core group, our opening day lineup, so to speak, playing more as a unit together earlier in spring, whether it's 7 or 10 days prior to the end of the season, as opposed to just the final 2 or 3 days, so that they can develop some sort of rhythm. You'll probably see some veteran guys playing a little deeper in the games earlier in camp. And again, the win-loss record in spring has proven not to have a correlation to in-season win-loss record. At the same time, we want to make sure the guys are getting enough reps and we're playing the game the way we want it to be played early enough in spring so that when we enter the regular season, it's a matter of habit and routine. Let's put it this way. The expectations are a lot higher this spring, in part because we know how important it is to get out of the gate quick.
You know, last year you were helped with the fan base was electrified because it was a 10-year anniversary of the World Series. You had a lot of festivities. There was a lot of buzz around White Sox baseball, even when you weren't winning on the field. This year, that's all gone. You know, and you look to the track record, you know, and beyond the playoff in 2008 against the Rays, you know, the White Sox have been absent from playoff baseball. When does that become an issue for the organization that, you know, you're seeing a bigger drought than maybe that you'd like?
Well, it's an issue for me every day, frankly. I mean, it has been too long. We had, you know, we were in a position in 2012 where up until about 2 weeks till the end of the season, we were in first place, and it looked like we were going to be able to get back there. And in 2010, we had a competitive club as well. But the reality is that there hasn't been enough winning for any of our tastes, whether it's Jerry, Kenny, myself, the players, the staff, in recent years here. Now, when you look at the nature of where we were a few years ago and the nature of the game right now, in 2013, we were a 99 loss team. Traditionally, as you go through the process of putting yourself back in playoff contention from that sort of bottoming out level, it does tend to take, in some instances, 5 years, in some instances, even longer. We've decided to approach it based on the fact that we started this process with guys like Chris Sale and Jose Quintana under control, and we're able to quickly add guys like Jose Abreu and Adam Eaton, Carlos Rodon to the mix, and now Todd Frazier. We've approached it as we're going to try to take as much advantage of the growth of this core as they go through the prime of their careers to get ourselves into playoff contention and back to winning playoff games as quickly as possible, as opposed to stripping things down and going through that sort of 5 to 7 year total rebuild. That said, it doesn't make us any less impatient to get back there. And we feel like we're in a position right now, even without additional, even if we're not able to convert on any additional targets between now and opening day, that we're back in a position to contend in what should be a very competitive division.
Does it change the fact at all, you know, how you approach your team, building your team, or the idea of winning when the World Series winner is in the division? The Royals are in the division. Does it change the way you approach your ball club?
Not entirely. It does. It's a real factor because of the fact, and they've been good for a few years now. And you know, those who have seen how that team was put together and how they've grown through the minors and what they've been able to develop over the last several years in Kansas City. You knew they were going to be good and you knew they were coming, just like Minnesota's on the upswing now. Part of the equation in deciding whether it's time to go for it or how realistic of a chance you have to win is obviously looking at what you're competing against, you know, 18, 19 times a year in your division and how you stack up. So it's absolutely a consideration. At the same time, we're in a division with several clubs that have the ability to either beat each other up or get on a hot streak and open up a little bit of space, and we feel we're one of those clubs. And you know, I do think in the last several years we've seen, not just in the AL Central, but, you know, throughout baseball, the addition of a second wild card creates a whole other opportunity for clubs to get in there. And those opportunities can sometimes go for 85, 86 wins, which if you have a good club that has some growth capabilities in it and the ability potentially to add to it at the deadline, that opens up the opportunity for the postseason to a lot of different clubs. And as I said, we feel we're positioned to be right in the square of that mix for the division and the postseason.
Last question for you. You know, you mentioned expectations, or, you know, how you guys were. The preview last season was that you were going to be better than it ended up.
Mm-hmm.
Which do you prefer? Because the division is going to be Royals, Twins, probably Tigers, then you guys when it comes to the forecast. Do you prefer sort of the underperforming expectation, or do you prefer at the beginning of the season to be, you know, with a target on your back?
You know what? It's funny because there's enough opinions out there every year that you could really position yourself as everything. We had one more advanced sabermetric website named Fangraphs last year had us pegged for 77 wins, despite the fact that, you know, places like Fox Sports and others were predicting us to not only win the division, but to win the World Series. This year, as you said, there's some places that perhaps will have us in third or fourth place in their prognostications. Fangraphs has us in first. There's a little bit of something for everyone out there, and I think that's probably as indicative of the fact that the division's going to be really competitive as much as it is about our current talent and the growth we have. At the end of the day, it's probably the old axiom is it's probably easier to be the hunter than the hunted, and given that we do have the World Series champion in this division, you know, they're the ones with the target on their back. We're the ones who probably have something to prove, not only to White Sox fans, but the rest of baseball and ourselves, given the fact that we didn't live up to our expectations last year. And I think I like going to camp with a little bit of an edge and guys feeling like, you know, we need to show the world that last year was not who we are.
Oh, we like to hear that. Rick Hahn, general manager at the Chicago White Sox. Rick, good luck this season. We hope to check in with you regularly. Thanks for joining us tonight.
You bet. Thank you, Justin. Take care.
And each time I hear your name.
My, how it hurts.
Yes, oh, it's that time of the week here on the download. It's Friday night, so it's time to put Shark Tank Steve Gadlin into the frying pan. Gadlin, of course, the brainchild behind the successful local business, IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. He presented his business idea on the television program Shark Tank, and he snagged Mark Cuban as a principal investor. So now Steve has to go back to Cuban with new ideas. But before he goes into that pressure cooker, he comes to WGN Radio to jump into the frying pan. He's giving us his exclusive business ideas so we could poke holes in it and give Steve the confidence to pitch it to Cuban himself. Steve Gadlin, welcome back to the frying pan.
Hey, thanks, Justin.
Good to see you.
It's so good to see you too.
You know, we had such a layover almost, like, or time off around the holidays. We didn't get we didn't have consecutive frying pans.
Right.
So it's good to see you week to week here.
Thanks, man. I think you'll see you give me consecutive weeks and the ideas get exponentially better. So.
That's the hope, I think. You know, we got you for a couple weeks straight here.
That's
okay,
right.
You know the drill, everybody. 312-981-7200. You can call or text that line, and you can essentially say yay or nay on Steve's idea, give him questions, comments, that sort of thing. And Steve will do his best to explain,
refute, defend,
and try not to get angry.
Sure.
Or frustrated.
Yeah. You know, all criticism or disappointed. Is constructive criticism.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Steve Gadlin, all right, buddy. Why don't you tell us this week's frying pan idea?
Okay, so this is I think people are really going to like this one. I have a problem, and I'm sure others have this problem too. Sometimes you just feel crabby.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know you're crabby because maybe you don't make a crabby face, and they come up and talk to you all happy, and it really frustrates you. Or sometimes it's the other way around. Maybe you walk up to someone in a happy mood and don't realize that
they're crabby. Right. Happens
so,
all the time.
You know,
yeah.
It's like putting your foot in your mouth. No one likes the taste of leather, if you get what I'm saying. So what I've invented is something called the crab cake. Okay?
Crab cake.
The crab cake. This is a cake. It's like a little birthday cake that you wear on your shoulder, an actual cake. And what that does is two things. It sends a signal to people approaching you. Oh, he has a crab cake on his shoulder. He's feeling a little crabby today.
Okay.
So instead of talking to you, maybe they can stop and then you both share a piece of the cake. And by the time you're done sharing the cake, maybe you're not so crabby anymore and you do want to talk. Or maybe you're still crabby and you don't want to talk. But either way, you've given fair warning with a crab cake.
Okay, I've got questions.
Okay.
All right, 312-981-7200 is the number. Crab cake.
The crab cake, yes.
The crab cake.
It attaches to your shoulder on a little harness, and okay. You bake it the same way you would any other cake, but it's a way, at the beginning of the day, if you're feeling crabby, you stick a crab cake in the oven, you mix all the ingredients together, and you bake your crab cake. And then you wear it on a shoulder harness, this bright, colorful, almost birthday-like cake. You wear it on your shoulder just to let everyone know, hey, I'm feeling a little crabby today. Caution.
Yeah. And it would be an, okay. The number, okay.
And then it's something you can share with people to maybe break the ice and ease off on that crabbiness.
Ease off on the crabbiness,
maybe,
right.
Yeah,
maybe.
Possibly.
If that's what you want to do.
Right.
Because you're not trying to change behaviors.
No, we just want, you know, this is a fun way for a crabby person to share that with the world in a way that feels less confrontational. Takes a little bit of effort, obviously. You got to bake the cake. You've got to wear it on the leather shoulder harness. And you've got to walk pretty steadily so it doesn't fall on the ground. But what it does is it really sends that signal. Hey, everyone, I'm feeling crabby today, but instead of sending that negative energy into the world, here's a birthday
and
cake.
And that's a good – I could see how that isn't a problem,
yeah.
Because we've had problems where you're crabby and people come up and they're happy and that causes confrontation. So
yes.
I can understand where there's a need for something to deal with that.
I see this as real big in workplace atmosphere. I see this as huge in school, college students who maybe studied up all last night and they only had a couple hours of sleep. So before they go to class, they make a crab cake, put it on their shoulder, just again as fair warning to the world. I'm trying to tap into how millennials operate, right?
And well, I think you always...
that's a whole new market, are these millennials. And what I think this does is it really taps into their need to share in creative ways.
All right. Well, the calls are calling. Great. The 312-981-7200. The texts are coming in as well. Yay or nay on the crab cake. We're going to take a break so Pete can get everybody screened. And we will be right back here on the Frying Pan.
And each time I hear your name...
How it hurts. There it is, the Frying Pan here. It's Friday night on the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest, Steve Gadlin. He's the man behind IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. He's got a development deal, investor deal with Mark Cuban. Before he brings his ideas to Mark, he brings them here to the download. It's a sort of workshop. It's a workshop.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, so this week it's called Crab Cake.
The Crab Cake, yeah. It's a way to tell the world that you're feeling a little crabby, so maybe their interaction with you is a little more guarded.
Mm-hmm.
You, in the morning, if you're feeling crabby, you whip open the crab cake. It's a box full of different cake ingredients. You just add 3 eggs, and you bake this crab cake and put it in the shoulder harness so you can wear it around town or at work or at school. And what it is it's a symbol to people. It's a way to communicate that you're crabby in a way that adds positivity to the world, not negativity.
Hmm. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Leah. Leah, crab cake, yay or nay?
I think that's a great idea.
Hey!
What if you are working outside and it's drizzling? What are you going to do? Are there going to be crab cake umbrellas?
Crab cake umbrellas. Thank you, Leah. Thank you for that. That's not a bad idea.
It's a great idea. It's actually one I had thought of earlier. We are also marketing add-ons for the crab cake. So not only umbrellas, But, you know, different color shoulder harnesses to match your purse or your briefcase or your outfit. Match, you know, kind of a, there's a Bluetooth add-on too because it can connect to your phone, obviously, using Bluetooth. So it's, yeah, that's a great idea. That would be extra, of course, you know, but, you know, a lot of people are very crabby on rainy days.
Yeah,
so we see that as a, that's a big add-on, you know, an extra $70 or $80.
All right, 815 says it should be called a Krabby Cake in honor of SpongeBob SquarePants. Vote yes.
Okay.
So there you go.
I'm
so,
not familiar with SpongeBob SquarePants or Krabby Cake, but
okay,
that's great.
All right, well, let's go to Kathy. Kathy, you're on the frying pan. Yay or nay to crab cake?
I like it. I'm crabby in the morning sometimes, and this would be a good way to be pleasant about it to your fellow coworkers.
Yeah. There you go.
And I think you should make it in the microwave. That there's a type of muffin you can make in the microwave. It'd be easier to put together
in
the morning.
That's a great point. Thank you, Kathy, for that. That's very efficient.
Well, look, I don't know how to make a cake, so it's my assumption that they're all made in the microwave. So I don't know exactly how this is made. I know you mix the powder with some water and milk, and you put in a couple eggs, and you heat it up somehow. But it's really not how you cook it. It's how you frost it that makes a difference because there's, you know, we include several suggested patterns and several different frosting types as well. And we suggest a real brightly colored frosting pattern. Real intricate, just again to show people to add that positivity into the world instead of the negativity that comes with being crabby.
I'm amazed that you've gotten three in a row here are likes. I mean, that's crazy. This is something new. So let's keep going. 312-981-7200. A lot of texts coming in. We'll get to those. Let's stay on the calls. Let's go to Carol. Carol, yay or nay on crab cake?
Oh, I guess I'm a little too old, but while I'm listening, I have another idea for you. I say nay because I'm old enough to remember mood rings.
Right.
So I kind of been there, done that, but you were kind of touching on all your different ideas. You maybe need to look at how about colors, like an app that would, everybody has their phone. I mean, nobody's without a phone in their hand. Mm-hmm. So you make colored apps that let people know your mood.
Well, this is similar, Carol. But this is a
thanks,
cake.
Carol. Thanks, Carol.
This is a cake that lets people know you're crabby. The crab cake.
Right. I think she's familiar with that. She's just saying that maybe, you know, you'd want to get more.
Well, fine. Maybe you should make a car that flies to Mars and call it the Mars car. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of ideas out there, but the business idea that I've thought of is a product called the crab cake. Now, it's a cake that you bake and wear on a shoulder harness to let people know you're feeling crabby.
Oh, all right. Okay. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And I would almost put our last caller in the yay category, even though she said nay, because she was at least building using improv techniques, using yes and things like that just to give you suggestions.
I don't think improv techniques impress investors, potential investors, but that's
773 is along the same line. She says, I love the idea.
Okay.
But I think it would be better if it were a pin instead of a cake.
Again, that's an entirely different product. I've invented a product called the crab cake that you bake in the morning and you wear on your shoulder using a shoulder harness to let people know that you're feeling crabby in a way that breeds positivity instead of negativity. It's as simple as that. Yes, you can put on a pin. You can put on a funny hat. That's not what I've invented.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
847, can the crab cake come in different flavors? Chocolate? Are there vegan or gluten-free options?
That's a great question. Our initial crab cake actually is crab-flavored. So it is a chocolate vanilla mix with crab bay seasoning and other seafood flavors. That's what distinguishes the crab cake from, say, a birthday cake you might get at the Kroger.
It tastes good, though, right? I mean, it's...
Well, it's not so much meant for eating as it is for displaying.
Oh,
we find the crab, the actual crab meat in the cake, thickens it in a way to withstand some of the more, you know, there's a lot of daily grind that goes in with wearing a cake on a shoulder harness throughout your entire day.
708's got one here. So if I'm in a bad mood, I need to make a mini cake and then wear it. Do you supply the tiny cake pan?
So common misconception, I don't know where tiny's coming from. This is actually a full-sized 8-inch cake, so it'll fit in a standard cake pan. If you don't have an 8-inch cake pan, we do sell an 8-inch cake pan. But yes, the first part minus the mini part, they are absolutely correct. You wake up in a bad mood, so to expend positive energy into the world instead of expelling that negative energy. You mm-hmm. start the day baking a cake to let people know you're feeling a little crabby.
309 says, you can't balance a cake on your shoulder.
Well, you can with the shoulder harness that we, and that comes with it. That's not even an added charge. I mean, it justifies charging $80 to $90 for a crabby cake because this is real, genuine leather, mm-hmm. Cured leather. And with that, with gyroscopic and Bluetooth technologies, we're able to keep the cake steady.
Another great 847 says, why waste food? Why not just make it a t-shirt or a hat or a shirt?
Again, those are other products. I've never heard one. You know, I'll tell you this. I've been around the world.
Or sticker. She's a sticker. Sorry.
Fine, a sticker. But I've been around the world many times. I've baked a lot of, well, I haven't baked a lot of cakes, but I've seen a lot of cakes. And never one time, never in my life have I heard anyone look at a cake and say, that's a waste of food.
Okay. Well, so. All right. Let's go to the line. Let's go to John. John from Milwaukee. John, yay or nay on crab cake?
Oh, I would say it's a big nay. How are you going to have time in the morning if you're already in a bad mood? How are you going to have time to make this thing?
Right.
And how do you know when you wake up that you're, like, in a bad mood immediately? It's got to take you at least half an hour, I would think, to bake this thing. It's just, I think it's one of the most impractical things I've ever heard of. I honestly thought y'all were just spoofing on this thing. I mean, obviously, if you get Mark Cuban to invest in you, you must be very smart. But although his team is getting killed tonight, they're down 40 after the first half.
Oh, okay.
But anyways, it's good for you. I just think it's one of the most ridiculous things.
Okay, well, appreciate that, John.
Heard.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I appreciate that feedback because honestly, not seeing it in action, I can understand why he would call and say that. But as someone who's watched people use this thing when we've been beta testing it, it brings a smile to every crabby person's face. The smell of that crab meat and bay seasoning when this thing is baking at 425 is enough to turn any frown into a smile. And then, hey, you've got a cake too. So,
okay.
You know, and how do you know when you wake up that you're going to be crabby that day? I think, you know, through self-reflection, through meditation, that's a personal thing. And,
right.
and you know, maybe John's not our target audience, and, I, you know, more power to you, sir. But I tell you, at the top of that call, he sounded a little crabby. I kind of wish he was wearing a crab cake.
Ah, there you go. You wish he had a crab cake.
Yep.
That's right. Okay, so let's go ahead and let's take a break, then we'll get to the news. 312-981-7200. Right now, I have to say, you know, you had a couple of yays right at the top that have made this almost like a foot race for whether or not this is a successful idea to pitch Mark Cuban.
Right.
312-981-7200. We're here with Frying Pan Steve Gadlin, the idea crab cake, a cake that you wear on your shoulder when crabby to let everybody around you know that you're crabby.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty simple. 312-981-7200. We'll be right back.
And each time I hear your name.
My how it hurts. All right, it's the download tonight, Friday night, 10 o'clock hour. It's Frying Pan, Steve Gadlin. He is the man behind IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. He won on Shark Tank, got a development deal with Mark Cuban. Before he brings new ideas to Mark Cuban, he brings them here to the download, to the Frying Pan. Steve Gadlin, quick elevator pitch. What's the idea tonight?
Yeah, this one's so simple, Justin. It's for when you're feeling crabby. Mm-hmm. It's called the crab cake, and it's a cake that you bake in the morning and wear on your shoulder using a leather harness. And what it does is it lets people you encounter know ahead of time that you're feeling a little crabby. Maybe they need to back off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It also gives you an opportunity to spread positivity in the world instead of spreading negativity through your crabbiness.
Mm. Okay, let's go to some texts, and then we'll keep going with some calls. 563. How do you keep it from getting in your hair?
Oh, that's a great question, and something we have done a lot of testing with. The crab cake actually comes with several accessories, one of which is a hair net that actually binds your hair very tightly to the top of your head and then over to the other side.
Mm.
So we've tried it with several hairstyles. It seems to work fine. It's very fashionable, and It keeps hair, it keeps most hair from getting into the cake.
312-981-7200. 224 says, maybe a crab cake snack cake individually wrapped for those of us on the go who don't have time to bake.
Well, that's not who this product is for. You know, this is a cake that you wear on your shoulder using a leather harness to let people know that you're feeling a little crabby.
Okay. I'm trying to find one we can read on the... Okay, let's go to set. Let's go to Susan. Susan, yay or nay on the crab cake?
I'm yay.
Hey, all right.
Oh, thanks, Susan.
However, I brought up the point of, you know, I'm a language teacher. Hmm. And I encounter 12 different languages in my class where I teach at the college I teach at. They wouldn't get this at all. So I think what you're doing there is you're taking out a market, you know, and working with Mark Cuban, you want to global.
Why wouldn't they get it?
Well, because, you know, it's like when you say crab and crabby, well, we would see a crab. But if you're going to say, like, for example, if you say fish in Spanish, it's pescado. Mm-hmm. But being crabby is not pescado-y or something like that.
Oh, I see.
So
yeah,
you have
right.
to realize that that's why language acquisition theory, you know, puns. Mm-hmm. No, it's not grammar. It's just jokes.
Well, look,
puns.
I okay. hate to
Great.
Underestimate.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Yeah, I don't like to underestimate non-English speakers, though. I think they'd understand it. It's crab cake, and what it is, Susan, it's a cake that you wear on your shoulder using a leather harness to let people know you're feeling a little crabby.
Hmm.
I think they'll get it.
They think, okay, well, 312-981-7200. You didn't answer the question, is it vegan friendly?
Well, no, there is crab meat in the cake. There is actual crab meat in the cake.
And that's
so,
not vegan.
No, it's not vegan. I don't know if there's gluten in in crabs or not. So I don't know if it's gluten free or whatever that one is. So I'm not sure. Yeah, this is, you know, you don't have to eat it though. That's the thing. Its main purpose is to alert the people you encounter that right. you're feeling a little crabby.
773 says, can you balance two cakes on your shoulders?
Can I?
No, but I mean, I think they're asking, can you do maybe like two cakes?
You can put one on each shoulder if you've got two leather harnesses. That's fine, but that's not what this is. This is one cake you'd wear on your left shoulder to alert people that you're feeling a little crabby. Now, we sell it with one leather harness. So you're not even balancing the cake. That's got gyroscopes and Bluetooth in there, so it connects to your phone.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to fall. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to try to balance it. You shouldn't hop curbs or skateboard with it. But, you know, other than that, it's pretty self-sufficient. So you can wear two if you want. That's not what this is. I'm never going to stop a buyer, though, from
buying
picking up
two,
an extra one. Yeah.
And what was the cost again? We missed that.
Well, it's still, you know, because there's actual crab, and this is Alaskan King crab baked right into this cake. It's upwards of $90 for one crab cake, but we sell them in packs of five. So you could be spending, nine times five is $450 before tax for a starter kit.
Let's go to Tina. Tina, yay or nay on crab cake?
Yay or nay. How about a third category? Interesting hum. Mm. I realize it's a savory cake. I personally do not want to eat or partake, share from somebody walking around with this. People are gross. Coughing, sneezing.
Right, I didn't think about that.
Flushing toilets without closing the lids. And vermin following you. This is a tasty, savory cake, huh?
Well, it's not all about eating the cake. It's about alerting the people you encounter that you're feeling a little crabby.
Another form of communication, just nonverbal?
Yeah, nonverbal communication that alerts the people you encounter. You know what? I'm feeling a little crabby today. Look at this cake on my shoulder.
I think I'll save some bucks and just wear a scowl on my face.
Well, that's one way to do it,
but that adds negativity. I like your idea of setting positivity.
You. Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Take it easy.
Thanks, Tina. So you turned a no into a yay.
Well, I turned a hum into a yay.
That's right. Easy. You did, yeah.
A no's a no, but a hum's a yay.
312 wants to know why not skip the harness and just pin it to the top of your head like a yarmulke or a man bun.
Well, this is an 8-inch cake, triple layer. There's no way if you just pin it. I mean, what are you going to pin it to? No. I challenge you to balance a 3-layer 8-inch cake with candles, lit candles, by the way, on on any part of your body without an approved leather harness. We've got a patent on this thing.
Mm. 630 says, what about fruitcakes? Would fruitcakes work?
to send another message? Sure. This is a crab cake made with real Alaskan king crab. It's a cake you wear on your shoulder using a leather harness to let the people you encounter know you're feeling a little crabby.
Hmm. 630 says, the leather harness says leave me alone. Why add the cake?
I don't know that a leather harness necessarily says leave me alone. Mm-hmm. In some communities, that's a sought-after accoutrement.
Yeah, that's a look, right.
Yeah, people might think you're S&M or one of those, you know.
Right.
There are plenty of reasons to wear a leather harness besides balancing a cake. Let's just put it that way.
What about for specific things? This is good. 312's yet. How about a model for crabby brides? You know, you hear about Bridezilla, maybe a crabby bride.
Well, the great thing about the crab cake is it's universal. You don't need a special model.
Right.
Maybe there is a formal one you can purchase for a little more money. It's formal cake. But, you know, it depends what your wedding is, if it's cash, if it's formal. Either way, that we don't need a special model for that. Crabby is crabby. We all know that.
Right. All right, let's go to John. John, yay or nay on the crab cake?
Well, I think it's a good idea, and people will get used to it. But I'm wanting to know, what if you woke up and you just weren't crabby? What if you were PO'd? Are you going to have a double harness where I can have two of them?
Well,
that's good. That's good.
We
Thank
won't
you.
Have a double harness, but you can purchase two harnesses. So the way we've worked this out, putting on a harness is only going to cover one side of your body. So it's perfectly – you can wear two. You know, I wouldn't suggest it. People might – misunderstand what you're doing, but hey, we're never going to stop you from doubling up on it.
630 says, why not just a plastic cake?
Well, you know what, I challenge 630 to invent the plastic version of this and see how well it sells. I'm working with investors here. I think there's a lot of luxury to be had in real Alaskan king crab meat baked into an actual cake. Why not a plastic one? Well, okay, when you go to the car store, say, oh, I'm sorry, could you point me to your toy cars? These real cars are nice, but I'd like to drive a toy car. You know, that's what that caller said.
All right, let's go to Brian. Brian, yay or nay on the crab cake?
Nay. This is for real?
Yeah. Why? What about it makes you say nay?
I mean, I just can't fathom seeing a bunch of people walking around with a strap around on their shoulder with a cake.
Hey, well, Brian, I bet the people who had never seen a bicycle before probably couldn't fathom someone wiggling their legs around and zipping up and down the streets before the bicycle was ever introduced. This is a new idea.
What kind of market are you trying to get? I mean, who's going to pay $450 for this?
Well, not just for one. I don't know if one person who says, you know, I'm only crabby once a year. Come on. This is anyone who's ever felt crabby and wants to spread a little positivity in the world instead of the negativity that goes along with normal crabbiness. This is real Alaskan king crabby.
T-shirt saying I'm crabby.
Well, fine. Wear a T-shirt that says I'm crabby, but what opportunity do you have to share positivity with them? You know, I'm talking about being able to give someone a slice of cake with real Alaskan king crab baked right into it.
That sounds disgusting.
Well, that's your opinion.
Might be a taste thing. Thank you, Brian. Thanks for that. You know, I know a
chef at Gibson's right now who doesn't think that's disgusting.
Okay, well, so you got a chef from Gibson on this product?
No, I'm just saying. I bet I could call one and explain that to them, and they wouldn't think it's disgusting.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's premium products in a luxury presentation.
Let's go to Heidi. Heidi, yay or nay on the crab cake?
Nay. Is this cake like in some sort of a container or protective wrapping?
No, it is balanced on your shoulder using a leather harness.
Yeah, but in the summer, like, wouldn't it attract flies and bugs?
Well, the consistency is a little different than your normal birthday cake. Since 40% of the actual filling is real Alaskan king crab meat, it handles differently than would maybe, you know, the frosting outer half or the baked dough.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll finish up with Steve, read some of the more pointed commentary that came in from text here for Crab Cake on the Frying Pan. Stay with us.
And each time I hear your name.
Frying pan. Oh, my, how it hurts.
Hey, it's the Frying Pan, Friday night here on the download. Steve Gadlin from IWantToDrawACatForYou.com brings his latest idea to us. Tonight's idea, crab cake. It's a cake that you wear when you're crabby around your shoulder. on a harness to let people know that you're crabby, because
that's an issue.
Now we're going to get to my favorite part of the night, which is where we read most of the texts that came in that really aren't that constructive.
Okay.
They're more nays and here's what I think, or yays. Just kind of want to get everybody in, because I think everybody out there who participates during the frying pan, it really is, it's great. Thank you so much. 606 says, I think you've had too many Cabo Wabos tonight. They have a drink of some sort.
I don't know what that is, and I assure you I've had none.
773 says, I would never wear a cake like this because what if a dog attacks me?
Well, you know what? That's something you, it's a risk you take every day no matter what you put on.
Right.
What if you're wearing a meat necklace? Then, you know the risk is what I'm saying.
Right. 708 says, I know this is stupid. And this is the first time I've heard this. And I listen to WGN all the time. Crab cake, stupid.
Okay. There are a lot of thoughts there. I think they had a little trouble.
Yeah, 309 says, who wears food?
Well,
708 says, that's just nasty in the summer. The smell, no.
No, we're talking actual Alaskan king crab meat, though. So.
630 says, thanks for spreading stomach viruses, jerk.
Okay. Well, that's not, you can't pin that on one person.
Yeah, well, 630 says, if you were crabby, why would you want to share cake? That's a good point.
Well, because what's the alternative? Just snapping at people the way these textures are doing?
Let's not get defensive. 606, this one's personal. The psych ward is down the hall, first door to the left.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do they know what direction I'm facing? Just,
That's a great point. 309 says, no. Last thing I want to do is when I wake up in a bad mood is bake and mess up my kitchen. Go away.
Well, again, two totally separate thoughts. I'll say that that's the point of this, is to bring you from bad to better, to spread a little positive energy in the world instead of carrying your bad mood with you for the entire day.
630 says, are people supposed to eat it off your shoulder?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't finish. Okay. You're a moron.
They didn't even know how to eat a cake, so.
Right. Well, okay.
They had to text in and ask me how to eat a cake, so who's the moron?
How and why, this is 708, how and why does this connect to my phone?
Right, so it's Bluetooth connected.
Right. Again, I'm sorry, I should have finished.
Oh.
Must it be my left shoulder?
Yes. Well, the way the harness is built, you use it on your left shoulder. Now, if you're left-handed, you'll have to wear the cake backwards on your right shoulder, but it will be backwards cake.
Oh, it was a 708, it was a two-part text, came in a little bit later, said, this guy should be committed.
Got it.
So there's that on the end.
I tell you what I'm committed to is bringing excellent products to excellent people, and that's a commitment I will never drop.
708 says, no offense, but this is the stupidest idea I've ever heard.
Okay.
If I'm crabby, I'll let people know.
Yeah, and one way you can do that is by spreading positivity by wearing a crab cake, a cake on your shoulder, and a leather harness.
Okay, let's just rabbit fire here. 847, horrible idea. 847, is this guy brain damaged?
No.
Let's see. I'm trying to reread that one. Brain damage. Tonal lunacy. 630 says total lunacy.
Mm-hmm. They might be talking about some of those other textures because this, I thought we had a string of yays there, and now I'm a little surprised by, I don't know if you're selectively filtering them or how this is working.
No. I'm going down because I'm trying to, 630 says, we read this one, would fruitcakes work?
Mm-hmm.
But then the one after it, the 630 says, this guy's a fruitcake.
Got it.
So.
Well, I can take that two ways, so.
708, he's a moron. 815, what's wrong with this guy? Mm-hmm. 773, it's stupid. 630, you'll attract insects.
You know, one of the things that you set up a format for people, and you ask them to say yay or nay, right. And they're coming in with all this excess commentary that's just really irrelevant.
563 got really colorful. It's a longtime listener. If I get his Me First app, can I be the first to hit him in the face with the cake? That's creative.
Well, at least they're talking about hitting me in the face with a cake and not actual fisticuffs, because then I'd have to, I don't know what you do in that case.
Okay, and then the rest of these are pretty much redundant, except for there's one I wanted to find, terrible idea, moron, this is idiotic, eat it right away. Can you balance it? There was a good one. Anyway, it was something around a-hole, and I can't remember what it was. Okay. Something like that. Okay. Anyway, so Steve, it's hard to say, but I will say this. Much more positive this week than the previous week.
But really polar. You know, the positivity was great, and then the negativity, I'd say, cut extra deep this week. And if there's ever a reason for a crab cake, it's listening to some of the negativity spewed by your listeners this week. And, you know, I even hesitate to call them my listeners after hearing some of those words.
No, I mean, I think that you're going to get that. I think there is some truth to the fact that, you know, I do read all the tweets, so they know it's going to be read, so they're having fun at your expense.
I'll be.
But you did hear some callers say, yeah, I like the idea.
Well, now I wonder if they were being sincere or if they were just having a laugh.
No, that's the hard part about this, because, you know, you've got to go in with a lot of confidence to pitch to Mark Cuban.
I don't got it with this product.
And you don't have
it. Honest. Be honest.
Darn it.
Yeah, next week.
Steve Gadlin, I want to draw a cat for you.com. He's also the co-host of The Frying Pan here. He brings his ideas here, and we kind of workshop it, give him a yay or nay. And, you know, I don't think this one, he's got the confidence. So next week?
Yeah.
Next week?
I've already got an idea percolating, and I think your listeners are really going to dig
it. All right, Steve, thanks for being here, bud.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it here for The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, in place of Patty Vasquez tonight is Matt Bubala. Matt, good to see you.
In place of, but not replacing.
Not replacing.
Not replacing.
Just
nobody
in for
can
tonight.
Replace
is
Patty
she in
Vasquez.
L.A.?
She is in L.A.
I love it.
She's coming back.
She's
I think,
our superstar.
Man. She is our superstar.
She's got a sitcom deal. She's working it. She's hobnobbing. She's probably right now at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
I don't think so.
Hey.
I think
like
she's
her
and
George
Casa
Clooney.
Right now.
Yeah, right.
Patty's the hardest working woman in show business.
She is, man. I hope at some point we'll get a cameo in the sitcom.
Is that what
done.
You're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I don't need a line.
See, it's tough
I don't
because
need a line.
You're like, Patty, just put me in the show once, but then you don't know what she's going to give you.
Yeah, I'm okay
you know?
With that. I'll be in the background. I'll be the guy who's standing in line at the In-N-Out Burger or some like so I'm just the scenes like over here, just so I can get like my arm in it.
You just want
I'm
an
okay.
arm.
I just
Patty,
want
just need an arm. Just
Let
give me a hand.
Just one arm.
You have to go get a distinctive tattoo so you can say, that was my hand. See the flower
Did you
on
see
That's
my cool?
Hand.
Did you see
my
tat.
Cool?
My new tattoo.
Justin right, what's Kaufman, the... guy playing pinball.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Oh, guy playing pinball would be cool,
that
resume.
That would be great. To be great.
Check me out on IMDb, guy playing pinball.
Patty, if you're listening, I just need a little help.
Start
that
at a party.
I need guy playing pinball. All right, what do you got tonight?
I like that. Troy Laravier is a principal.
I love that guy. Love
He's
him.
Great,
yep,
isn't he?
Yep.
So I'm guessing, this is my guess. I don't know this for sure. But this might be the one time he says, you know what, I'm with Rahm. I wonder what he'll say about Governor Rahm trying to do this little, let's take over CPS. So we'll see what he says about that.
He's a great outspoken principal.
He is. And, dude, he needs a leadership position. We need to get him somewhere.
That's a great idea.
He needs to get higher up in management.
Well, more
far
too often principals, you know, because they're worried about their job and things like that, they keep quiet. They like to stay. I've covered education enough to be able to go. And,
yeah.
And Troy's been a guy who's talked and given us insight.
He's
and
willing
I,
to stick his
I
neck
admire
out there
I admire
and take
it.
The heat that comes with it. Because he has taken some heat for it. And he's
and,
a great guy.
But his school has turned around, which is good.
So. Yeah, he's in a really good school, and he's a good guy. So he'll be in to talk about that a little bit later on. We're going to check in with a guy out at the MGM Grand in Vegas, talk about what the latest lines are on the Super Bowl, and talk about what some of the fun prop bets are that you can make.
I saw that.
If you're going to visit Vegas this weekend. So lots to do. On the Patty Vasquez
I
show
love it,
coming
man.
Up. Where you, what are you doing for the Super Bowl? You got a big party?
I don't know,
going to?
Man. I thought about it. We were invited to a Super Bowl party, but I have a feeling I'm going to like go to the grocery store tomorrow and be like, oh, man, I should just cook those wings.
Yeah.
You know, and then I do it, and it never turns out right. And it's
you
just
cook
gross.
Your own wings?
I'm the sucker.
There's
I'm
places the, now where you can actually just buy them like pre-made.
Yeah,
and they'll
that's
put
what
them
I
in different sauces.
No,
and
I
stuff,
do that. And then I
and
put
then
in
you
the
just eat
and I just I mess it up. I mess it up.
Jewel, man, guys, go to Jewel. They've got great wings.
The Jewel's got good wings. Rob's right.
Yeah,
the
really
Jewel
do.
Has really good wings.
Maybe that's
actually.
The problem. Maybe it's because I'm going to like the high end, like I'm going to Whole Foods or something, and they're like, "Well, do you these are great.
A little
these
too
are,
much.
These Look, are
much.
These are free range wings.
Free range seitan wings.
They've been eating grass. That's also free range.
Free range wings. Don't do it for me. No, I just feel like I get the pre made, and I'm like, "Oh, this is good. Oh man, it's wings time," and then it just doesn't taste right.
It's not good enough.
No, it's never good enough. So what are you doing?
We usually have a couple of friends over, so we got a couple of friends come over. But we haven't figured out the food yet. Kelly's freaking out about it. I got to host a trivia night tomorrow night at our local school, and we got a Super Bowl thing. It's just we overdo it. So I don't know. We're ordering beef or something.
All right. Well,
free range beef, Rob. Free range, baby.
Grass fed. See you next. I'll ask you what you got for what you made for Super Bowl Sunday.
All right, sounds good.
All right,
have
man.
A good weekend, buddy.
You too, buddy.
This is Chicago's News and Talk. No, what is this? I don't even have the thing for. I'm gonna go to 10 years ago, Rob. This is Chicago's News and Talk, Radio 720 WGN. What are we now?
You
what
got
are
it. We, Justin? No, Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago. WGNradio.com. You got to do the web.
Yeah, we got that.
So much web.
Yeah,
it's the web's the future. It's the future.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
All right.